You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning, this is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the December 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Following the downing by Turkey of a Russian fighter jet over Syria at the end of November that it claimed violated Turkish airspace, U.S. warplanes have been accused by Damascus of launching a missile strike at an army base in the Deir ez-Zor province on Sunday, which killed 3 Syrian soldiers and wounded 13 more, destroying in addition a number of military vehicles. The U.S. has denied it was behind the attack and blamed the Russians, but we've come to know what our military denials are worth.
The attack would be the first of its kind since the U.S.-led coalition started to bomb Syrian territory more than a year ago, and both incidents heightened the threat of an unintended confrontation between Moscow and Washington. At a news conference in Paris last week, after honoring the victims of the November 13th terror attacks, Obama cited the even more deadly explosion that tore apart a Russian civilian airliner over the Egyptian Sinai last month, blamed on ISIL, to critique Russian President Vladimir Putin for not having brought an end to the Syrian conflict during the brief time the Russians had been involved there. Said Obama, "The Russians now have been there for several weeks, over a month, and I think fair-minded reporters who looked at the situation would say the situation hasn't changed significantly. In the interim, Russia has lost a commercial passenger jet. You'd seen another jet shot down," he coolly went on, as if the deaths of 244 civilians, mostly tourists, and the Russian pilot were Putin's fault and not worthy of the condolences extended to the French. "And I think Mr. Putin understands that," said Obama, "with Afghanistan fresh in his memory, for him to simply get bogged down in an inconclusive and paralyzing civil conflict is not the outcome that he's looking for," end quote. Given that the U.S. has been bogged down in Afghanistan far longer than were Soviet troops nearly 4 decades ago, and that Obama has reneged on his earlier commitment to bring all American forces home from Afghanistan, he is hardly one to talk. What Obama has had trouble learning, at least in public, is to talk tough to Turkey, Washington's NATO ally. It not only shot down the Russian fighter, claiming that it had violated Turkish airspace, but since the beginning of the armed conflict to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, it has been an indispensable asset to all the Sunni groups and the non-Syrian foreign fighters who compose their ranks, including Daesh or ISIL. From the moment that the peaceful protest against the Syrian government turned violent, Turkey began allowing foreign Sunni fighters to cross its borders into Syria to wage war on the Alawite Assad government. At the same time, it was permitting the weapons for them to fight with, provided by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and from the pillaged stocks of the overthrown Gaddafi regime to cross the border as well. It has also become widely known, and most surely by Obama, France's Francois Hollande, and Britain's David Cameron, that their ally has been enabling ISIL to finance its war in Syria and Iraq by facilitating the sale and shipment of oil from the territories it has captured in both those countries on the foreign market, which reportedly includes Israel. Why the Turkish government shot down the Russian jet and the latest developments on the Syrian front will be subjects for discussion at 20 minutes past the hour when I speak again with investigative reporter Gareth Porter. Last Wednesday, if we were to believe the government and the mainstream media, the war against ISIL came home. It took the form of a bloody massacre of employees at a social services center in the Los Angeles suburb of San Bernardino. As it happens, I was driving to San Francisco that afternoon, following the story on the radio, and later on TV at the friend's home where I was staying. I had heard reports that witnesses had identified the killers as 3 athletically built white men dressed in black military-style garb. Within hours, however, they had been transformed by the media into 28-year-old Syed Rizwan Farooq, born in the U.S. to Pakistani immigrants, and his diminutive Pakistani wife, 27-year-old Tashveen Malik, and that both had been killed several hours later in a gun battle with a San Bernardino SWAT team, which was conveniently holding military training exercises a few minutes away from the shooting site. What is curious is that a week after the event, the only people who have been interviewed by the media about the identity of the killers were a man and a woman who questioned separately claimed that they were three white men. The man, Juan Hernandez, was interviewed by the local NBC affiliate as well as ABC, and the woman, Sally Abdul-Majid, who said she worked at the center, spoke to CBS by phone. How long these interviews will be available on the Internet, I won't speculate, but I recorded both of them to play for you today. We'll begin with Juan Hernandez speaking on the street to an NBC reporter.
Where I was at, now there were three white men in military fatigues taking off.
What were they driving?
It was a black Impala, SUV.
You think that they might have been the shooters?
Yeah. The way they were driving, yeah.
Yeah. And how many shots did you hear?
Oh, a lot. It was a lot. It sounded like, yeah, like I said, it sounded like a gun range, just shots going off like crazy. It was a lot. A lot of shots.
What's your first name?
Juan.
Juan, what's your last?
Hernandez.
All right, thank you.
That was Juan Hernandez, and next, Sally Abdul-Majid, who said she worked at the center. Here she is speaking to CBS.
One of the witnesses today is Sally Abdul-Majid, who works at the Inland Regional Center, the building where the attack took place. She saw the attackers enter the building, and we spoke to her by phone.
I heard shots fired, and it was, from an automatic weapon. So, very unusual. Why would we hear shots? As we look out the window, a second set of shots goes off, and it's just pop, 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 pop. And we saw a man fall to the floor. Then we just stopped. We just looked, and we saw three men dressed in all black military attire with vests on. They're holding assault rifles, and they opened up the door to Building 3. And one of them opened up the door to Building 3. He starts to shoot. He just, shoots all over into the room. That's the room that we typically have conferences in. And we just heard more gunshots go off. I got my phone. I reached for my phone. I called 911. And I just hid under my desk. I didn't see anymore. I just heard more gunshots go off as I was talking to the dispatch. We went into my manager's office, locked the door, barricaded it. We heard running and things happening upstairs. About 30 minutes later, someone came to the door, knocked on the door, but we didn't obviously answer. And then another 15 minutes later, someone came and took us into a secure room.
Ms. Abdul-Majid, can you describe to me in as much detail as you can, what did the gunman look like?
I couldn't see his face. He had a black hat on, and from my view, all I could see was just a black hat and black long-sleeve shirt, possibly gloves on. He had black cargo pants on, the kind with the zippers on the sides and the big puffy pockets. He had a huge assault rifle, and he had extra ammo. He's coming ready for something to reload. I don't know. He had like magazines. I couldn't see what else. I just saw three dressed exactly the same.
You're certain that you saw three men?
Yes. It looks like their skin color was white. They looked like they were athletic build, and they appeared to be tall.
And, of course, we've just learned that one of the suspects was actually a woman.
And that was the last we heard of the three white men. I have found no record that either of those you heard had been interviewed by the police or by the FBI. No one, it seems, among the wounded survivors was able to identify either Farouk or his wife as the shooters. According to the L.A. Times, Denise Palazzo, who was shot in the back, quote, told friends and family members that the doors of a conference room had opened and two people dressed all in black wearing black face masks entered with big old guns and started shooting randomly. The guys opened fire for 30 seconds randomly, then paused to reload and began firing again, she said. After she was shot, the shooters were gone. Everything was silent until the police arrived 5 minutes later. In an interview with CNN's Chris Cuomo, the Farouk's family attorney, David Chesley, noted, quote, that there are a lot of disconnects, and there are a lot of unknowns, there are a lot of things that, quite frankly, don't add up or seem implausible. Speaking about Tashfeen Malik, 27, the attorney said, she was never involved in shooting. She's probably 90 pounds, so it's unlikely she could even carry a weapon or wear some sort of vest or do any of this. Addressing some early accounts of the incident, he said, where, quote, where the couple was found, from what I understand, that they were handcuffed, lying face down, and this truck shot up. There's a lot of things that just don't make sense, end quote. Those are the words of the Farouk family lawyer, David Chesley, and in the days since, they still don't make sense. There indeed was a photo that appeared on the internet purporting to be the body of Farouk in a black military-style outfit lying face down on the street near a pool of blood with his arms in handcuffs behind his back. It would not have been easy for him to engage in a shootout with the police in that position if indeed the body in the photo was his and a shootout had taken place. Certainly they would not put handcuffs on him after he was dead. Well, if you weren't told they were police, you would have believed that San Bernardino SWAT team was an Army unit since they were dressed in military-issue desert warfare uniforms and riding around in intimidating military vehicles, the kind the police brought in to counter demonstrators in Ferguson, Missouri, after the police slaying of Michael Brown. Although they were unable to prevent the slaughter at the Social Services Center, you can be assured that their use in San Bernardino will be seen as justification for the further militarization of our police forces. The AR-15 assault rifles that Farouk and Malik were alleged to have used were purchased illegally by a friend, a private security guard named Enrique Marquez, in 2011, who checked himself into a mental hospital until Sunday to avoid being questioned by the police or FBI. According to CBS, after breaking windows and using a cutting torch to get into his garage, quote, law enforcement is also taking their time with respect to Marquez because he is the only credible eyewitness they have, and they do not want to corrupt his potential testimony. The source says officials are not frustrated by not being able to interview him so far, end quote. Not being able to interview him in the hospital? Does anyone believe that? In any case, he left the hospital Sunday and submitted to questioning. But of course, there's no indication that Farouk's former neighbor was at or anywhere near the Social Service Center and therefore could not have been an eyewitness to anything that happened there. One of the questions that had been raised by those questions, the official narrative, was how a couple of amateurs could have managed to conduct such a professional-style raid without prior weapons training. That was supposedly answered yesterday when the L.A. Times reported that Farouk and his wife had gone to gun ranges in the L.A. area in the days before Wednesday's massacre. So far, officials have produced evidence that Farouk did take target practice at one local range a few days before the shooting, but nothing has yet emerged to indicate that Malik did so as well, and for that we only have government statements to rely on. The same is true of the report that at the moment that the attack in the center began, Malik, using another name and apparently using her cell phone, had posted her allegiance to ISIL on Facebook. It was quickly scrubbed. After the FBI had earlier announced that Farouk had not been on their terrorist watch list, the L.A. Times heard from a senior federal government official yesterday that he was in contact with a small number of suspected extremists and with at least one person who is currently being monitored as a potential terrorist suspect. There were some other strange developments, one of which was even puzzled the mainstream media. The home of the alleged shooters was turned back to the landlord by the FBI and subsequently opened up to the media 2 days after the shooting. Crime scenes for simple murders are kept intact by authorities, often for weeks. Many viewers, quote, many viewers and media analysts were surprised at the scene, wrote the Wall Street Journal's reporters, who were also at the apartment, with critics saying news media may have compromised a crime scene and acted irresponsibly by releasing sensitive, personally identifiable information about those who lived there. CNN and MSNBC came under the most criticism, said the Journal writers. MSNBC showed photographs and IDs of people who weren't known to be suspects, end quote. MSNBC later apologized, but that is the least damage that can come from the event, which is likely to make life far harder on America's Muslim community and anyone who might be mistaken for a Muslim than did the events of 9/11. Already, As you are probably aware, the Republican candidate, the leading Republican candidate for president at the moment, Donald Trump, is calling for the government to shut the doors on all Muslims seeking to enter the country, including those who live there and want to return to the United States. That's the kind of statement that endears him to the racists and xenophobes who make up a major segment of the Republican Party and its base, and what has helped him top the party's polls in every state. His competitors for the nomination are probably no less racist or xenophobic than the Donald, but believe they have to be more clever about letting the public know about it. Last Thursday, Trump demonstrated that he doesn't care who he offends. "You're not going to support me because I don't want your money," Trump told members of the Republican Jewish Coalition, a hard-right pro-Israel lobbying organization funded by Sheldon Adelson, and was what was essentially an audition to see who would get some of Adelson's millions after in this election campaign. After putting down his rivals for taking major PAC funds, Trump said, quote, "That's why you don't want to give me money. Okay, but that's okay. You want to control your own politician. That's fine. Good," he added. Trump also questioned at one point Israel's commitment to peace and refused to call for Jerusalem to be Israel's undivided capital, provoking a wave of boos in the audience. Anyway, this morning on Morning Edition, you probably heard that Trump's leading challenger, Ted Cruz, says he disagreed with Trump's position on Muslims, but he pointedly declined to criticize him. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, from a perspective all too lacking in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The times are devastating for Palestinians, as we know from the stream of news stories that report how particularly young people, in their desperation, living under the suffocation of Israeli military occupation, are increasingly deciding to take their stand against this military oppression by lashing out with random stabbings and assaults on Israeli citizens and even the military. Most of these assaults lead to the death of the Palestinian, as the stated Israeli policy is to shoot to kill in such instances. This really is a form of suicide, a choice by young Palestinians who see no future for themselves and finally decide to make a final act of resistance through martyrdom. It is a tragic sign of these desperate times for the youth of Palestine. The response of the Israeli military is to clamp down even more dramatically by raising the level of collective punishment on the Palestinian people. More checkpoints, more house demolitions, more land confiscation, more restrictions on travel, more violent responses to nonviolent demonstrations. Recently, Palestinian activist Nancy Murray returned from Israel, having led a delegation for the Interfaith Peace Builders. Nancy has been a frequent traveler to Palestine for two decades, and therefore is uniquely qualified to help us gain some perspective on the current difficult times in the Middle East. We sat down with Nancy to get her take on conditions in Palestine following her recent trip, and also to discuss her work locally with the Boston Alliance for Water Justice.
Nancy, thank you for speaking with us on This Week in Palestine. You're recently back from yet another delegation, yes. Leading a delegation for Interfaith Peace Builders. I understand there were several local Bostonians on the trip.
Well, mainly from Massachusetts, not so much from Boston. We did have another Cambridge resident, but most of our 10 representatives of Massachusetts were from other cities outside. Okay. Yeah.
Tell us the purpose of the trip. What did you expect to accomplish, or what were you hoping to do?
This is the 55th delegation organized by Interfaith Peace Builders. And they have a very clear purpose. They don't want people just to go and look as voyeurs. They want people to be active on their return. So there is a two-day training process before people go, in which they learn about the issue. They get packets of reading material. Then they learn more about the issue. They learn about what to expect at the airport. They learn about how to begin to think about interfacing with the media, with Congress people on their return. This trip had 35 people on it, so it was very large. As I said, 10 were from Massachusetts, there were a group from California, and then the rest were scattered. But we keep in touch. So on our return, since we've been back, we have been encouraging each other to write articles, reading each other's pieces, sharing articles. So for at least a year, there's intense back and forth among members. I led a trip with Interfaith Peace Builders 2 years ago, and that group still keeps in touch with each other. So it is a group that is not just going as a kind of leisure sport. I mean, they know they're making a commitment.
There's a purpose.
And they know that they're expected to share the stories, to try to talk to friends, not just friends, but in our case, we had five ministers, pastors with us. So they were thinking of how they could reach out to their congregations. Others were more activists from other struggles, Nicaragua, sort of 80s struggles, the Iraq War, and this was their first visit to Palestine. In many cases, people came with some background, but not having visited. But in some cases, they had very little background. And I must say, it doesn't take long to begin to see what's going on. And I would say within a few days, everyone was pretty much up to speed.
Right. Well, you're a frequent traveler to Israel, Palestine. In fact, how many times have you made this trip?
Well, I haven't kept count, but this might have been the 14th or the 15th since 1988.
You started in 88.
Yeah.
What was it like this time as compared to other times in terms of your ability to travel, to pass through checkpoints?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we could travel because we had a yellow license plate, i.e. a license plate from East Jerusalem, which is different from a West Bank license plate. So we could go through the faster lanes of checkpoints. That didn't mean that we didn't at times get stopped. When we crossed from the West Bank into Israel at the Jalamé checkpoint, which is up near Jenin, we not only got stopped, we were all taken off the bus. We had all of our luggage searched and our cameras taken apart. And they then gassed the bus. This is a new procedure. They bring over some kind of a gadget that pumps vehicles, and they were doing it to cars as well, full of gas. In the case of a bus, it took quite a long time. And, no explanation what they were doing. But we waited there for a half an hour watching them do it. And apparently it was to detect some sort of bombs. So we did get, because we had been in the West Bank, we got that treatment. But in terms of what Palestinians go through, our yellow license plate helped us avoid the worst of the delays and the worst kind of treatment that they get routinely.
But this was unique to this trip, this kind of a search?
No. I mean, generally speaking, whenever I go, since they've created all these checkpoints, you get searched in some capacity. But now, given the time frame and what's happening there, you could never predict when you will be stopped. At one stage in this trip, we were at Kalandia checkpoint, which your listeners may know is a very large one separating Ramallah from Jerusalem. And some of our group wanted the experience of walking through the checkpoint. So they got off the bus and, you know, they were going to walk through. We then get a taxi on the other side. So we expected to see them much later at the hotel than the group that stayed on the bus. We thought that they would go through with relatively little trouble. Well, what happened was the bus went through with relatively little trouble and then got to another so-called flying checkpoint, which hadn't been there in the morning. But because some kids had thrown stones at cars, we were there for 3 hours. The bus just was stopped with no word of explanation. And this is what travel is like now around the West Bank and into East Jerusalem. You don't know if you'll get to appointments. You don't know how long it will take or if, in fact, you will be able to succeed in accessing a particular neighborhood of East Jerusalem or a particular village in the West Bank. I mean, it's just all very random and impromptu. And in addition to these massive transit places that have been established since Oslo, there are now, you know, hundreds of these other obstacles and checkpoints.
And in terms of the folks you met with there, were there any common themes? Was there something you heard again and again and again?
Again and again. You know, since I was last there 2 years ago, I was struck by when we met with Israelis, the remnants of the peace movement, that is, boycott from within, new profile, these groups, I was struck by how exhausted they looked and how deeply depressed they were by their own society, by the fact that the racism in Israel was becoming so blatant and so out of control, and the hatred directed not just against Palestinians and so-called Arabs, but against them, was really clearly very hard to deal with because they were standing out against government policies. Within the West Bank, it was, you know, people are struggling. They're still fighting. They're not giving up hope. But the sense of total despair in their own leadership, I mean, there is no leadership. That was certainly a theme, the feeling that, you know, here they were. They can't get a sense of direction from leaders because there aren't any. They've been corralled into these tiny areas which prevent them from moving and organizing across the West Bank. At the same time, and they're seeing, you know, settlements just, you know, galloping along, more and more land being taken, more and more water resources being taken. So there's this sense of, you know, how are we going to stop this? Now, that doesn't mean people have given up. In Hebron, which is perhaps one of the most depressing places one could go, it's a virtual ghost city in the H2 region, which is the region around the mosque, which in 1994, that's the mosque that Baruch Goldstein from the settlement Kiryat Arba entered and killed 29 praying Muslims. And as a response to that, Israel basically put the entire area under curfew, and it has not really changed. It's been under intense restrictions ever since.
And the settlers are particularly aggressive in Hebron.
Incredibly aggressive because they have the total upper hand. We even heard that there was some Israeli army general there who they felt was being too friendly with shopkeepers. And so they ordered him to be replaced, and he was. But even there, which was the bleakest possible place, you know, we met with Issa Amro of Youth Against Settlements, who has been arrested 16 times this year, hundreds of times in all, and yet he is determined to carry on with his nonviolent resistance. And he really does believe that in the end, because the cause is so just, it will prevail. And so when you meet people like that, it really makes you feel you cannot be in despair. But it's hard, you know, just looking at the place and remembering what it was like when I first saw 1988, how much has gone against the Palestinians. It's hard not to feel, you know, unless the world wakes up, you know, this is just going to continue and continue, and Palestinians are paying a very high price.
And what about Bethlehem and the Aida camp? That's another flashpoint.
Yes.
And of course, we have many friends in Bethlehem and in the Aida camp. And
right. Well, that's again another place where you just wonder how people endure, because it has been bathed in tear gas. This is Aida camp in particular, in the area of Bethlehem around Rachel's tomb, which is now an army camp. I mean, not just tear gas. It's like cascading poisonous chemicals that have just enveloped the camp.
And why is Aida camp such a flashpoint?
Well, it's a flashpoint because it's bang up against the wall. There is this army base very nearby at Rachel's tomb, and kids throw stones as an expression of resistance to what has become of their, you know, hopes for a future. And so, you know, they have been playing a cat and mouse game with the soldiers. When we were there, on top of the Laji Center roof, the soldiers came and fired tear gas, which enveloped us, and we got a little taste of what Palestinians have to live with the whole time. Arrests of, you know, recently a six-year-old was detained in the Aida camp. This is not unusual. They came in recently, they left, but they came in and planted themselves on the roof where we had been standing when we were tear gassed. They put a Israeli flag up, you know, and that's just a taunt, the kids. So it's a kind of ongoing, you know, cat and mouse, because the Palestinians are not going to say we give up. You know, they do sense that they have the right of resistance. And resistance in this case means they are going to let Israel know any way they can that they are not going to submit to the occupation. So if it's a matter of kids throwing stones or writing on the wall, which, you know, the huge separation wall surrounds Aida camp, they will write on the wall.
Yeah.
In one case, they, you know, burned the wall. They tried to make a hole in the wall. You know, these are the kinds of acts that Israel then comes, the Israeli army comes, you know, roaring in and, you know, tries to really, well, succeeds in intimidating and injuring and arresting and in some cases killing camp residents. And that is an ongoing issue, an ongoing sort of pattern, which is not changing. It's getting worse as these months go by since October.
And what about in the old city, the military presence in the old city, which can be very, very heavy at times?
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting experience going there, because we went there on our first day. And, you know, here I was with a group of Americans, most of whom had not been there before, and they thought, this isn't, you know, we thought it would be more tourist, but this is, this seems kind of peaceful. Well, the reason they thought it seemed peaceful was because there was no one around. I mean, they did not understand that, you know, people were not out in the streets because they are afraid of the army. They are afraid with this impunity with which soldiers are shooting. You know, if somebody holds up something that looks like it could be, you know, a device, like a weapon or a, might be a pair of glasses, you know, who knows? Mm. They could get shot. So, you know, once they understood that this is not the normal pace of life in the old city, you know, they kind of started looking with other eyes. One thing that surprised me was how many settlers there are in the old city now. You know, it used to be when Sharon made his provocative entry into that one building in East and hung his flag. You know, that was putting a stake in the ground. Well, now, you know, it's
all over.
Yeah, it's riddled with little settlements.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is the plan?
But we were there at a time when a lot of East Jerusalem's neighborhoods had been completely cordoned off because of knife attacks. The army had been routinely raiding hospitals and. October, they conducted 7 raids on hospitals, including 4 on Makassar Hospital, the major hospital. And when I say raids, I mean, this includes doing something they just did again, which is shooting tear gas into hospitals. Now, in Hebron, the day after we left, they went one better than shooting tear gas, and they actually came into the hospital with an undercover group pretending to be taking a pregnant woman to have a baby. Mm. And then they pull out their weapons. They arrested this wounded guy who had been in one of the wards, and then they just killed his cousin when he was leaving the bathroom where he had gone to
right
wash
in the hospital?
In the hospital. They just shoot spray bullets, blood and gore everywhere inside the hospital. So these are the kind of acts that are happening now with very little attention from the mainstream media, but much more attention from the social media. So you could understand why the Israeli deputy foreign minister went to see Google and YouTube and suggest that they work together to censor these.
Right.
Now, Google has said, well, it was strongly described. They didn't come to any agreement that she had just come to meet with them. But who knows? I mean, these are things, you know, now that is a lifeline for Palestinians to be able to get out these images and to get out their stories that way, because the mainstream media has been so lamentably
uninterested. Now, is there much pushback concerning Google on this, something we really need to do?
Well, Google did, I read on Alternate, that Google did issue a statement saying that it was just meeting with the deputy foreign minister to explain what mechanisms they have to retrieve, you know, material from the Internet that shouldn't be there. But they say they didn't come to any agreement to have this cooperative plan. We'll have to see.
We'll have to see, but it seems to me that if Google gets tagged with a censorship tag, it could be enormously problematic for them.
Oh, yeah,
because,
and I think they must.
Yeah, I mean, Google, you know, we depend on the Internet for precisely this kind of thing. And now when we begin to understand that perhaps we're not going to get everything, that's not going
to
happen.
Right. Well, we have to keep an eye and see how much, if things get blocked. But let me give you one example. So YouTube was the other agency that was named in this. Now, YouTube has had some videos go viral. One was that amazing one in Nabi Saleh where a Israeli soldier arrested the 12-year-old son with his arm in a cast.
That went viral.
Yes, Bassam Tamimi. So, and then the wife of Tamimi and daughter kind of beat off the soldier. Now, the interesting thing is what hasn't got so much attention is that since then, 20 youth from Nabi Saleh have been arrested. It seems to me that it must be in a kind of revenge by the army. Okay, you think you could, you know, mess with us. Well, so these 20 young men, this is only a village of 500 people, and they've now, you know, been imprisoned and they've been interrogated. And in Israel, as we heard from Physicians for Human Rights and as we heard from Adamir, that includes still very harsh and abusive treatment, sometimes rising to torture under interrogation. And, you know, it's just awful that that has not gone viral, news of that.
We hear disturbing things about the role of the Palestinian Authority in Palestinian society. Mm. What can you tell us about their current place in Palestinian society, how they're viewed? We have to put this against the history of Oslo, where the Palestinian Authority was gradually to take over the control of the West Bank.
Until 2000.
There were going to be land swaps, and the Israeli military was going to, you know, gradually relinquish control.
Yeah.
What's happened to that?
Well, let me just say that this is one of the, you know, as well as the fact you can no longer move freely as you could in 1988, this is one of the great sadnesses I have. Because in 1988, during the First Intifada, wherever you would go, there would be little kids chanting, PLO, PLO. There was such a sense that they had a leadership. Now, you go to Ramallah, there are these giant buildings that purport to be government buildings, Ministry of the Interior, Justice, and so on. Palestinians do not feel like they have a government right now. They know there is an authority, which in many cases is the only job in town. You know, you have to work for the authority, get
it's
a salary.
Immense piece of the economy.
Of the economy. And so for that reason, they don't really want it to disappear, many of them, overnight. But in terms of what else it is doing, they know that the security forces of the authority are working with Israel. They collaborate in terms of intelligence. They collaborate in terms of, you know, pinpointing people for arrest. And I thought back to something I wrote shortly after the Oslo Accords were signed in 1994. I remember writing an article describing the Oslo Accords as apartheid with joint patrols. And I think, you know, we have apartheid system, and we do still have joint patrols. Because even though President Abbas went to the UN and said Oslo is over, as far as I understand, they have not cut collaboration in terms of security forces. And I think Israel is very worried about this, if they ever were to cut this collaboration. Because,
but then the money would go, probably.
Yes, so they're trying everything to prevent it from happening. But the fact of the matter is, the PA security forces have been trained in the use of weapons. They have weapons. And if they ever decided, the Tanzim, if they ever did decide to not carry on with the kind of Oslo formula of working in, you know, areas A and B, to, you know, help Israel manage the occupation, then there would be real trouble. I think Israel is really afraid of that. The people look at what's happening with the PA. They know about the corruption. They know about the terrible treatment of dissidents. The PA has been just awful in what it does under interrogation to Hamas people, to all the factions that are not with them, in their view. And, you know, they really do say this has to go. But on the other hand, they can't afford for it to go because then, you know, they're afraid of the alternative, which is chaos, which is no money coming in at all, which is no jobs, no livelihood. So it's a very, very,
very
difficult thing.
Very difficult.
And
what's also problematic for the Palestinian people is this whole prospect of no elections, of their having no role in choosing their government. And when we had elections, the United States and Israel didn't like the way they came out because Hamas gained control of some areas. And so they just discounted the elections.
Yeah.
And so Abbas continues, and there doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon that would be a signal to the Palestinian people that they have any choice in choosing any new leadership.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, people, though, at the moment, that the horizon looks like there's no light. But people, I think, are feeling this cannot go on. I mean, you can't have a system, a situation like this endure forever. Now, it's clear one reason it can't go on is because Abbas is getting very old.
Right.
But then what do you have waiting in the wings? I mean, clearly the CIA was working with Dahlan before to stick him into Gaza, and he's clearly maneuvering to become a new strong man. But he's hated. And so there's a lot of different jostling behind the scenes that probably I certainly don't know about. But it'll be interesting. I mean, the situation is not sustainable for long. So I would say in the next few years, something will emerge. The question is what? I mean, we could no longer... I think Palestinians are not hoping for salvation through one strong man or one leader. Many young Palestinians are hoping that struggles that are organized from the grassroots can bear fruit. The problems are enormous because of all the divide and rule tactics that have gone on and because of the multiple hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of barriers and restrictions that prevent people from organizing and talking and meeting each other. So it's not easy, but individuals who are involved at the grassroots level are not giving up.
It's difficult because Israel knows how to work collaborators. They get people and they prey on their vulnerabilities, they threaten their families. And right. If any of us put ourselves in their positions, you know, what would we do? It's so who do you trust in the Palestinian society, and where are the leverages on people? It's just...
It is. And so in one sense, you have to look at what's happening within Israel itself and think, well, that's not sustainable either, because it's going so... far in the direction of this barbaric, racist, the kinds of laws that are being proposed and passed, and also this notion that Palestinians are not human beings. Now, this is not new. I remember in 1988 and 1999, you know, the terrible racism directed against Palestinians was on the walls. It was in the Israeli press. Israel Shahak used to translate from the Hebrew press and send these accounts of what, you know, was being said, and it was pretty shocking. But now there's no attempt to hide it at all within government circles, and they really are pushing for the kinds of laws I think they couldn't get away with then. And so everything is much more overtly racist and extreme. And a lot of Israelis are worried about the fact that people who can't stomach this are leaving.
Yes.
So sooner or later, you know, Israel has got to look at itself. Is this the kind of country we want to be?
Right. As bad as conditions are in Palestine, there are those such as Columbia Professor Rashid Khalidi and Ali Abu Nima and the Electronic Intifada, and others who see support for Israel beginning to crumble in the United States. And they look at the campuses. They even look at the vote on the Iran nuclear deal that perhaps indicates that Netanyahu has overplayed his hand. They're seeing such indicators as the Jewish lobby really losing in a big way on this vote, AIPAC losing in a big way on the Iran vote, and that is significant in terms of beginning to drive some cracks in this powerful Israeli lobby. So there seem to be some hopeful signs even here, or do you think we're grasping at straws on this?
Well, as far as the lobby goes, I've always been someone who thinks that you got to look at the big geopolitical picture, and it's true, they lost on Iran, but you know, Israel is succeeding because of the support of the U.S. in all sorts of other ways in the region. So the militarization of the whole region with Israel and the U.S. hand in hand, and the way, I mean, they've succeeded in breaking down strong governments, I mean, both Iraq and Syria, is, you know, pretty astonishing. So I think that still, you know, we're not going to have the Pentagon decide to cut Israel loose. And the question is always, how do you translate a change in U.S. policy? I agree that there is a very different picture now on campuses. BDS is certainly on the move around Europe and here. I mean, there have been significant victories. We went with Omar Barghouti, who gave us a breakdown of the cost of the Israeli economy now. It's beginning to be felt. So it's not just a symbolic thing. So all of that is happening. But the question is, how do you move all of that change in public opinion to a change in U.S. policy when it's really the military and our wars and the arms industry which is behind so much of it? And especially now with terrorism as this bugbear, you know, the scariest thing in the world, if you would, you know, listen to the media, the most dangerous thing in the world, that is giving Israel a real lease of life, its emergence as the national security, you know, authority. So We have
and
a way
to go. And Palestinians being the lab for new surveillance. And
exactly.
Jeff Halp has just written a book on that. I'm going to be dealing with that coming down the road. He's coming in February, so I'm looking forward to that. Okay, now I want you to put on another hat, that of a participant and, in fact, one of the chief architects of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. We've covered some of your activities on This Week in Palestine, but quickly tell us, why should water justice be an issue for us in the Boston area, and how does it relate to Israel-Palestine?
Well, after we came back from my last IFPB, Interfaith Peacebuilding Tour, we had gone into the Negev Desert. We had been to places within Israel. These are Israeli citizens, but because they were not Jewish citizens, they were totally deprived of water. Those are the Arakib Bedouin, who, you know, Israel wanted to get rid of them, and so it didn't give them any water. Meanwhile, by the way, their houses have been demolished 90 times now. Meanwhile, eucalyptus trees are growing in the desert, and there's irrigation just to get rid of them and plant them over with eucalyptus trees. So we saw that as an example of water injustice. Everywhere we went in the West Bank, we heard similar stories of farmers not being able to irrigate, you know, having to leave their land fallow. And if you leave it fallow for 3 years, then Israel can take
That's
it
right.
as state land. In the camps, we saw, you know, places where water hadn't been turned on for more than, say, a few hours every week. You know, so we heard all these stories of water injustice. And we came back, this was 2 years ago, to read a story in the Boston Globe that on one of Deval Patrick's trips to Israel, he made a couple, they had, his administration had consummated a Israeli-Massachusetts Innovative Water Partnership. And so that just seemed something we had to deal with. Here it is, a government, you know, embracing this
right.
water industry, saying this can save the world. You know, it's so advanced in its technology. And we knew that far from saving the world, it was destroying another people living next door to it with its water policy. So we started this. We actually got it to the point, now it's not probably all our doing, but I must say we were pleased to learn that the water partnership had been put on hold. We heard this just a few months ago, in October. Now, this could be a factor that the Deval Patrick administration was no longer there. It could be certainly, you know, I'm sure we influenced with our public activity, our demonstrations, our pushback. But for whatever reason, it was put on hold. Now we learned that these 10 senators from the state Senate, that's a quarter of the state Senate, were going on a trip starting today, I believe, to Senate.
Leaving today.
To go and, you know, learn from Israel, learn from its technology, and in at least case of a few senators, learn from its water technology. And we thought, uh-oh, here we go again. They're going to go. It was supposedly planned before the October knife attacks and so on. So it's not supposed to be seen as we're standing behind you, Israel, but it is sponsored by the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council, which has always, you know, been... It's a lobbying group that right as it was making arrangements to take these senators, it got the state Senate to vote on a resolution against Palestinians. You know, it's that kind of lobbying group.
Right, and they're paying for this trip.
And they're paying for the trip. Well, yeah.
Talk about conflict of interest.
Yeah, they say they got it's a grant from... another group to pay for the trip.
Well, but
they're organizing it. They've been sending, you know, any kind of community leaders, administrators, elected
federal
officials.
Legislators, Catherine Clark, Elizabeth Warren
right.
have gone
right.
on these junkets.
Right. So we, the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, took this up as a junket, that's a good word for it, which will be used for propaganda purposes by the State of Israel, and which will be seen as an endorsement of the status quo. And it is our position that the status quo cannot be sustained, should not be sustained. and has to be, you know, revealed for what it is, which will not happen on such a trip because it'll be a very partial look at what Israel is doing. So we had a petition, we had a press conference, we delivered messages, including messages from the Massachusetts residents who had been on the journey with me, and tried to say, don't go. Now, I'm not sure all of them are going. At least in one case, there was an interest in what we had to say. But we will pursue them on their return, and we have to figure out a strategy, what we really want to get out of this. But clearly, JCRC should not assume that it can take these trips in the future without there being significant pushback from the public.
Well, that's what's important here, I think. Yeah. We need to send a signal. We need to stop this kind of thing. And at least they should be embarrassed by this blatant conflict of interest.
Right.
Really. I mean,
right.
Someone's paying your way.
No, but this is after. So we get a new administration in. And there was a lot made out of the Patrick administration's foreign travel. You know, why aren't you staying home and doing the work of your constituents? And Baker, Governor Baker, had given an indication that he wouldn't be that sort of governor who would always be off on foreign travel. And yet when it was announced that these 10 senators were going, it was also said that he was considering going to Israel. And so we also went to see him, well, his staff, and gave them our messages. Because, you know, this is... The time is over to just be so blatantly one-sided and blind to the reality of what is happening in that region. Because what is happening in the region is leading both peoples to the edge of a cliff. It's going to make for a very dark future if we allow this to play out.
And Israel doesn't really see this. They don't see what's in their best interests.
No, well, because... Why should they? They can do this with impunity. The cost now, if it comes, will come through BDS. But they'll just say, oh, it's anti-Semitism and so on. But unless they are shown, it seems they have to be shown a truth about themselves and their behavior, which they have not been willing to face, which is they are really behaving in a way which... One day, history will judge them very harshly for what they're doing.
Well, they are becoming internationally a pariah state. They're very upset about this, and particularly upset about the fact that increasingly we are talking about the discrimination, the segregation in the Israeli society. We talk about an apartheid society. We talk about a Jim Crow. All of these are concepts that we understand in the United States, but have never really... applied them to Israel. Certainly our government doesn't apply them, but our government, you know, our representatives would be appalled if we in a sense, tried to reinstitute the kind of segregation laws here that we've had in the past. They would be appalled. But yet we fund this segregated society, billions of dollars a year, and there doesn't seem to be any pushback. Mm-hmm.
You know, what really alarmed me, as it has been my more recent trips, is the extent to which they are able, and they have been able, to lay over Palestine, their map of Judea and Samaria.
Yeah.
I mean, it is eerie to drive along and to think you're on this road that just points to, you know, signposts pointing to Israeli settlements with no mention of any Palestinian villages living there. And, you know, it is as if they have, you know, got a blueprint in mind. This is what the West Bank's going to look like. Mm-hmm. And it isn't the West Bank. It is Judea and Samaria. And they are now creating it. It's almost like a Disneylandization of that land. And we went to talk with a settler spokesman in the settlement of Scott. And she, I mean, the way she talked about it, that was it. I mean, and this is not one of the original religious settlements. This was a settlement that when Sharon was Minister of Agriculture in, I think, 81. He wanted security settlements, mainly settlements around Ramallah in this case, to be able to block the growth of Ramallah. So it wasn't one of these Gush Emunim settlements, which, you know, people think, you know, this is our divine right. But she taught that language. I think that language is now shot through the settler movement. And they really do see this as a God-given blueprint to the land.
And it should come as no surprise, because the Zionist vision has always been take the land from the sea to the, to the Jordan River. And the peace process has just been a charade to allow them time to do that very thing, take the land. That's what the settlement movement is all about, take the land. Yeah. Jordan Valley's gone, take the land. Yeah. And we're watching the vision play out.
We are watching it play out. But the question is, will, you know, the world stand by and not start bending the arc of history towards justice?
That's right.
And I think with BDS, I mean, there have been some very significant gains in Europe and even here, the AFL-CIO in Connecticut. In Europe, unfortunately, the EU just took a mini step towards saying, well, we have to label settlement products instead of saying ban settlement products. But, you know, that really put Israel on notice. And the sad thing is, now, it's like this, they're all terrorist mentality has also been played out on the landscape. So when you're driving along these roads, if there is a Palestinian city, they ignore the villages and the towns, but if there's a city, you get these giant red signs saying, danger, don't enter. Israelis are barred from entering there. It's a danger to your lives. I mean, the most inflammatory sign. Whereas every Israeli I know who did enter, say, Ramallah, or did enter Bethlehem, or did enter, you know, even Hebron, has been warmly welcomed if they come, you know, with the right intentions and not with a gun in their hands. Yeah. So
it's all part of the fear tactic.
Yeah, it certainly is.
It drives Israel and it drives us, frankly. Mm. Well, thank you, Nancy. We've unfortunately run out of time. We really appreciate your sitting down This Week in Palestine. You've been a guest before. I hope you will be in the future. And we particularly want to follow the exploits of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. We think you're onto something. Thank you for all your good work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Nancy Murray, author, activist, and organizer, discussing her most recent trip to Palestine and her work with the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you.
You have to treat the public as potential terrorists, not as citizens. It's a whole change in concept.
MIE terror identities form part of a wider international effort to initiate cross-border security networks, share relevant information among the intelligence community, and disseminate key strategic solutions to acts of terrorism and multi-issue extremism. Indeed, the ultimate aim of such practices is to rationalize all forms of extremism, including public acts of dissent.
You don't have in Britain the equivalent of the Shabak, the Shin Bet. That's one of the reasons why Israel is so important in training the British police and British security. The whole structure of control over the Palestinians in exports. So Israel is really globalizing Palestine. It's exporting the occupation outwards. Israel's framing, ability to frame and get us thinking with a certain language that prejudices the way we approach problems is also something that it exports.
This paper examines how a comparative fusion intelligence complex sought to reclassify acts of dissent under the rubric of counter-terrorism discourse. You're listening to episode 728 of Unwelcome Guests, Globalizing the Occupation. Israel's Service to the Hegemon, Britain's Fusion Intelligence Complex. I'm Robin Upton. We have two new contributors to the show this week. You've heard them both. I wanted to give an overview to the larger picture. It's a familiar larger picture. This is a new angle on it, looking at the commercial exploitation of the occupation to develop strategies, techniques, and weapons technologies for controlling subject populations. And if you're living in the UK or the US, well, this might help you understand the social changes going on around you. And we're going to be getting on to language changes in the second hour. Thanks to Michael Gilligan for supplying this recording. The speaker is retired anthropologist Jeff Halper, who's also head of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions. The book, which draws on his research in Palestine, is entitled The Global War Against the People, and that was the title of his talk at SOAS in London on the 8th of October 2015.
You know, the military security industries together are about a $2.5 trillion a year industry. So the impact of that on societies, and I'll talk about in a second, a lot of this comes from the poorest countries of the world that are some of the largest purchasers of military security. So it has a huge impact, and it has to do with capitalism and the whole capitalist order, because violence and inequality and exploitation and warfare and the need to pacify is inherent in the capitalist system. I'm trying to kind of grasp the big picture. The logic of violence and of inequality and of repression all over the world, in which I think Israel-Palestine is a microcosm. In other words, sort of Israel-Palestine in microcosm kind of captures a lot of the global dynamics between the global north and the rest of the world in all kinds of ways that I'll mention in a few minutes. So that's very useful. But in addition to the economic part of it and the inherent violence in the capitalist system, we're not really aware, and I put myself squarely in that category, we're not aware of where the military and security is going in terms of the technologies that are out there. Most of us come from the humanities and the social sciences. Certainly SOAS is that. And most of us, and again, I put myself in that category, have no idea what these mad, hard scientists are cooking up in their laboratories. We don't study science. We don't know much about science. And then you get young people, you're 25, 30 years old, with a $500 million grant from the Pentagon to develop some fancy military stuff in cutting-edge laboratories. We don't know what they're doing. In many cases, our whole concept of violence and how much we can be controlled and ideas of security are really outdated. We're kind of 19th century people and not even aware of the 21st century that's going to drop on us, or that is dropping on us technologically. And of course, a lot of the technology, the advances in technology, whether it's PCs or in medicine or almost anything, originate in the military. Because it's the military that has the trillions of dollars to play with. One of the smallest departments of the Pentagon, the American Pentagon, is called DARPA, D-A-R-P-A, which is Department of Advanced Research and Project something. And if you look at their website, their mission is to make science fiction real. Take the most science fiction-y Harry Potter, Star Wars, the most science fiction-y kinds of movies, and the idea is to make these technologies actually real and to implement them. It has a $4 billion a year budget. And it's one of the smallest departments of the Pentagon, but imagine having $4 billion to just play around with trying to translate video games into weapon systems. So that this is really, part of the problem is the source of technology. The technologies that we're living in that fashion our world are coming out of the military. So that in many ways, we're living in a military reality. And I think we're really facing a very totalizing kind of military security situation that we're not aware of at all. The left is simply not aware of it. You don't hear about it in demonstrations. You go to the World Social Forum or regional social forums. You hear about certain particular things. We've hit on drones. That somehow become an issue, drones. And here and there, there's, Elbit systems. But overall, we're not aware of the technologies, we're not aware of the dynamics, we're not aware of the politics, and we're not aware of the scale of military and especially security stuff. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book, is to kind of raise this issue onto the agenda of the left using Israel-Palestine as a vehicle. So in a way, it's not Israel-Palestine itself that I'm writing about, although it's what I know, and so it's easy for me to come to. But taking Israel is a very good case study, because if you're looking at militarism, you take the United States or Britain, global north countries, there's billions of dollars, and you have Tridents, and you have jet fighters, and fancy weapon systems, and it's simply kind of overwhelming power that they try to apply in places like Afghanistan, and it doesn't work, but that's the concept. You take a little country like Israel that can't produce those kinds of things, that's very small, Israel has to be much more strategic in terms of how do we serve, how do we
How do we fit into this whole military security complex? And in that sense, it's much more revealing of what that industry and where the industry is going and what the niches are that really show you much more where the future of conflict is going than if you're looking at a big military power. And in fact, Israel, the Ministry of Defense, and Israeli arms companies use the concept of niche filling. And I talk about it in my book, I'll mention it in a minute, so that you can really get a very good sense of how the whole system is working. I start with Israel, and I start with the question that Colin that I asked, how does Israel get away with this? You've got an occupation, 50 years almost, massive violations of international law, of human rights, it's brutal, and it's one of the most publicized conflicts, maybe the most publicized conflict in the world. I mean, it's right in the glare of the TV cameras, you know, everything is out. In the social media and so on. And yet, Israel's doing fine. It has the support of the British government, certainly. Horizon 2020, which is the main financial instrument of the EU, is funding Israeli military companies as well as other companies. Israel's status in the international community is pretty good. Maybe not completely with public opinion, but it doesn't care that much about public opinion. It measures how well it's doing by governments. You know, the Israeli economy is doing well. Tourism is up. Bon Jovi just came and did a concert. Roger Waters got upset, but who cares? And so the question is, how does Israel get away with this? And that really kind of got into a lot of interesting issues. Part of it being that a strategy of Zionism for the last 100 years has been to serve the hegemons. In other words, whoever the big powers are, it was Prussia and Germany 100 years ago and the Ottoman Empire, through Britain, France, the United States, but also linking to all kinds of smaller elites. You know, Israel is the number 2 arms supplier to China. Israel is the number 3 or 4 arms supplier to India. So that, you know, elites go, and then, of course, Israel is very involved, show you in a second, in the global south as well. So that Israel has a tremendous reach in terms of military security. And I think that gets to the question of how Israel gets away with it. Because the answers that you come up with, Israel gets away with it because of guilt over the Holocaust. Or the Jewish lobby. Well, one of the closest countries to Israel is Poland. And there's probably 5 Jews left in Poland. You know, one of the closest countries to Israel is Egypt. You don't have any Jews in Egypt. So that doesn't explain. And then you've got the Christian fundamentalists. Well, there's a lot of countries that are very close to Israel, like China and India, that don't have many Christians. I was looking for the elephant in the room, the big reason to try to explain how does Israel get away with this. And it really began to strike me more and more from what I know of the occupation, that the answer has to do with what I call security politics, which means the ability of a country to parlay its military prowess into political clout. Because if you have a military prowess, the ability to use and develop weapon systems, especially, that is one of the keys to bringing you at the table with the big boys. I mean, you think about it, you know, if Israel didn't have the occupation, it certainly wouldn't be a semi-member of NATO. It wouldn't be the fourth largest nuclear power in the world. I mean, Israel would be New Zealand. It'd be some little country that's a nice little country. But in other words, the occupation is a resource for Israel that gives it the ability to develop and test weapons that then plays into the security politics. Because what Israel's trying to do, and this goes back to the idea of serving the hegemons, the powers in Zionism. Because Zionism was always a colonial movement. And even 100 years ago, colonial movements weren't so popular. I mean, there was much more colonialism around. But the idea of a European people coming into Palestine, I mean, the Turks didn't like it too much. The Arab world didn't like it too much. The Palestinians certainly didn't like it. And there was always opposition. So this whole idea of how do we get away with it? How do we actually displace the Palestinians and take the country, despite the opposition of the local population, the regional populations, and to some degree, more and more and more, of course, global populations, is really the issue. So in a sense, Israel's trying to maintain its global standing as a powerful European democracy, All those are buzzwords, but that's where Israel is positioning itself, of course, that also wants to maintain its occupation. And so what it does is, then the strategy is to serve the hegemons. So how do you do that? You're a little country. I mean, Israel is a fraction of the size of Great Britain. How do you do that? Well, the resource that Israel has, I think, is the occupation. And the Palestinians that are in some ways the guinea pigs. It became clear to me as I was doing my work and politically as well that the issue isn't the Palestinians. Just to give one little example, the attack on Gaza last summer, the summer of 2014, by the military threat that the Palestinians or Hamas in particular posed to Israel. There was no real military threat. Certainly you can't explain the tremendously disproportionate amount of weaponry, of conventional warfare weaponry that was used in Gaza, unless you look at it as a laboratory, as a testing ground for weapons. So that, in a sense, Israel has this advantage of having millions of people, and not just an occupied territory, but the whole Middle East, in a sense, that can be used for developing arms, security equipment, tactics of pacification and securitization, and also framing. I won't get into that too much today. So that by then, the occupied territory and the Palestinians, as a way of developing these resources, where it begins to serve the hegemons of the world, and especially in the capitalist world that we're talking about, is by helping them to defeat resistance and to delegitimize resistance, which of course is called terrorism. The delegitimized resistance and any form of counter-hegemony, anti-systemic movements, so on. What I argue in the book is that Israel has a much more relevant form of military security system than the global north does. Because you don't have any more today interstate warfare. The last real conventional war, in a real sense, was Korea. You know, in the early 50s. I mean, you've had Iran-Iraq, and you've had some limited wars, the 1973 war, Yom Kippur war, and so on. But basically, even though we talk a lot about war and peace, and there's departments of defense and so on, war is really kind of irrelevant today. But war, again, and armies and these sexy weapon systems are what gives you prestige. Look at today, look at the Trident. You have the Trident missile that Cameron is trying, I think just gave £500 million to develop or whatever. There's no military need for it whatsoever. The British Ministry of Defense says Britain has no adversaries in a military sense that it could ever use the Trident on. But you see, the Trident, that's not the point. The Trident is a part of the basis on which countries show that they're powerful. Their status depends on that. And it also has to do with deterrence, you know, in the sense that we're the strong kid on the block and don't mess with us. But they're irrelevant, because for the forms of warfare we have today, that you could call securocratic wars, wars of pacification, the wars in Afghanistan, in Somalia, North Africa, in Latin America, all over the world, not only of the global north, but of their allies as well, are really wars of pacification. They're not conventional wars with enemies and purposes. And in fact, I argue that they're really wars that are intended to protect the capitalist system, because as resources become scarcer and scarcer, you know, one of the major forms of war today is called resource wars. You know, if you look at the Congo or Africa in particular, but the poorest countries in the world, many of them are actually the countries that are sitting on top of the most valuable resources. So how do you extract those resources while preventing a surplus humanity, which is the way the capitalist system looks at the 99%, or as Colin would say, the 99.9% of the people of the world as surplus? How do you keep them under control? These aren't issues for Trident missile systems, or F-35s, or F-16s, or nuclear submarines. All these sexy weapons that define the power of a country militarily are irrelevant. So how do you deal with the new kinds of of securocratic wars, counterinsurgency, asymmetrical wars, low-intensity conflicts, police operations, peacekeeping operations that are a part of all of this. Who has the weaponry and the tactics and the experience to do that? Israel. More than any other country, because Israel's been involved in a war of counterinsurgency for the last century. Israel has the weaponry, but not just the weaponry, the structures and the tactics and the models for pursuing the kinds of wars that Europe really hasn't been involved with, at least since the colonial days, for the last 50, 60 years. And so in many ways, Israel really is key to helping both the capitalist system and particular countries to defeat and delegitimize resistance and counter-hegemony. And in so doing, of course, that helps Israel then develop its arms and security industries. And again, Horizon 2020, which is the main EU funding arm, it gives a lot of money to Israeli... I mean, even now, I'm just here for a couple of days. I don't live here, but I mean, Cameron has said in the last couple of days that local councils in Britain aren't going to be allowed to boycott Israeli products or even settlement products because Britain needs Israel to defend it. You can't weaken Israel because by weakening Israel, you're weakening Britain's ability to defend itself. I mean, that's where the whole thing has been turned on its head. And it's true in a sense. There's a geographer in Newcastle called Stephen Graham, who's written a book called Cities Under Siege, in which he really shows how British cities have adopted securitization equipment and tactics and weaponry and so on from Israel. So that Israel in many ways is more advanced or more experienced and has more resources for pursuing these kinds of securocratic forms of warfare and of pacification than countries like Britain, whose arsenals are built for fighting World War II. They're not built for contemporary conflicts. That's a niche. That's a niche that Israel has found and is exploiting, and in which its repression of the Palestinians is key. So, you know, it brings up all kinds of questions. Why didn't Israel accept the two-state solution in 1988, when the PLO, almost 30 years ago, if it really wants peace and security, why didn't it grab the two-state solution? It could have had peace, security, and 78% of the country. 78% of historic Palestine would have been Israel and acknowledged as such, accepted as such by the Palestinians. Why didn't it grab that tremendously pro-Israeli solution? And I think the answer is because it needs the occupation, that laboratory, and it needs that dynamic to constantly keep developing arms, because this is the base. First of all, it wants the entire country, so it doesn't want to a two-state solution, but the added value is that also by suppressing the Palestinians continuously, Israel is developing tactics and weaponry of pacification, which is the basis, really, of how the capitalist system relates to everyone in the world through pacification. There's a fellow named Mark Neoclius, who teaches in Brunel, who's one of the heads of what's called the Anti-Security Project. And what they're arguing is that we shouldn't be using words like security. Because security feeds into the way the system wants us to think. It wants us to believe there's dangers out there. And who doesn't want to be secure? You know, I was in the Israeli airport leaving Ben-Gurion the other day. There were an American tourist couple that were yelling at the Israelis because they didn't have to, in Israel, you don't have to take off your shoes. You don't have to take off your belt. You don't even have to take out your computer. You know, they have other ethnic profiling ways. They don't use technology. They use much more invasive, in sense, ways of security. But, you know, they were arguing, how am I going to be safe on the airplane if I can't take off my shoes? So, you know, we buy into that. We internalize it. So what he's arguing, Neoclius and the others, are that we should be reappropriating the term pacification. And we're really talking about pacification. We're all being pacified. Now, that problematizes. That brings up issues. Security closes down all the questions. Of course I want to be secure. That's fine. Secure me and let me get on the airplane. Who wants to be pacified? Now that brings up issues of who's pacifying me? How are they pacifying me? Why are they pacifying me? You see, it brings up all those critical issues that are really critical, that are really going on, that the language that we generally use closes down. And so by feeding into this niche, Israel is allowed and enabled to develop its arms and security industries. Cameron says so outright. Through that, they garner support for policies that would otherwise be unpopular, like the occupation, and that feeds back into the whole system. I'll give you just one tiny example. Nigeria. Nigeria has always been very strongly supportive of the Palestinians. And last year, if you remember, the Palestinians went to the Security Council at the UN to try to get a resolution through to put a timetable on negotiations so it wouldn't drag on and on and on. Now, they knew the Americans were going to veto. So the idea was, let's make the Americans veto. And then it's very clear who's standing in the way of Palestinian liberation. So the idea was, you've got 15 members of the Security Council. If the Palestinians could get 9 to support the resolution, that would force an American veto, which is what they wanted to do. And they were relying on Nigeria to be that. They were sure this is going to work. And the vote comes up, and Nigeria at the last second decides to abstain. And the whole thing collapsed. The United States didn't have to do the veto, and the whole thing just dissipated. And the Nigerians explained afterwards in a very open way, Israel is the only country that's effectively helping us with Boko Haram in a security sense. Israel is protecting our oil rigs, you know, that are really the targets of a lot of resistance in Nigeria. For environmental reasons, economic reasons, and so on, so that, you know, this is a part of the strategy of serving the hegemons. And, you know, every country has a vote in the UN. So, you know, Nigeria is just as important in the Security Council as the United States in that sense. So that by spreading its military and security reach, and here's where you see in a country like Nigeria, or Equatorial Guinea, or Burma. In certain countries, it's not the military that's the most important, it's actually the security forces. Because who your enemies are your own people, not some foreign enemies. And so Israel, again, with the experience of the Palestinians, is very good at exploiting that. And so what I'm trying to show in the book, in a way, and again, this is why I took Israel as a case study, and that is that Israel is in a very interesting pivotal position. It's very close to the major powers. I mean, it has a formal treaty as a strategic ally of the United States, and I go into that as well, but also Britain and NATO. It's in the NATO neighborhood. You have NATO exercises. Israeli weaponry is integrated into NATO weaponry and so on, and into the global north in general. But Israel is also very... very, very tied into local hegemons all over the world, the local elites in virtually every country, including, of course, not just the elected elites, including mafias, including drug cartels. In Colombia, there's a very famous Israeli arms dealer named Yair Klein, who was the head of an Israeli network of mercenaries, Israeli mercenaries. Israeli mercenaries were training the Colombian army, and the paramilitaries, and the drug cartels. So all these three sides that are fighting each other were all being trained by Israel. And that's the point. If we're serving there's a certain amorality about Israel. The whole idea is we can't choose our friends. We serve anybody. Anybody that serves our purposes of maintaining the occupation, of maintaining our status in the world, and so on, we'll work with. So that Israel, you know, and one of the reasons why Israel has such a reach is because there's no laws in Israel, like there are in Britain, for example, against taking bribes. When you're in a lot of countries, you can't do arms deals without taking bribes. All the ethics connected to business don't apply in Israel. So Israelis, in a sense, are like fish in the water. You take the roughest countries, and they love it. The countries that would eat up European business people, so that Israel spans the major powers but gets down to the local level everywhere. Israel also has a great deal of experience in conventional warfare. You know, it's fought 5 or 6 conventional wars. But at the same time, with the Palestinians in particular, but also you bring in Hezbollah, you bring in Lebanon, Jordan to some degree, Israel has experience in what's called warfare amongst the people. Or as my book says, war against the people. The whole integration of security and policing with war that you don't have in countries like Britain. Because the problem in the global north is that you've always had a separation, a wall, between the outside and inside, M5 and M6, military, policing. The Western countries always had that separation. And so when you're moving to a securitocratic situation like most of these countries have done after 9/11 in particular, they don't have the structures. Israel is the only Western country that's always had an integrated military security police. You don't have in Britain the equivalent of the Shabak, the Shin Bet in Israel. That's one of the reasons why Israel is so important in training the British police and British security, because it not only has tactics and weapons, it has structures that integrate these things. And Israel is very good at high-tech weapons, but also field-friendly weapons and tactics. You know, one of the problems with the American army is they have these fancy weapons with all their gadgets, and the soldiers can't use them. They're too sophisticated for the soldiers, even some of the rifles. So what Israel does is it knows how to strip down weapon systems, make them user-friendly in countries where you have child soldiers that are 12 years old, but keep the capabilities of the weapons. So in all kinds of ways, Israel has a very interesting pivotal position. I've sort of identified 4 niches in particular that Israel fills in this system. One is it does provide high-tech weaponry and components to conventional military forces. I mean, it does serve the militaries, even though the militaries are kind of irrelevant. But its other niche is developing weapons for what's called hybrid warfare and securitocratic control, or what are called weapons of suppression. Professor Leeds Stephen Wright, who has a website called Stop Killer Robots, has written a lot about weapons of repression, or weapons of suppression, which is policing and securitocratic control. Israel also offers a model of securitization, which is the matrix of control. In other words, the way it controls the Palestinians, the whole structure of control over the Palestinians, it exports. So Israel is really globalizing Palestine. It's exporting the occupation outwards. And then there's the whole issue of framing and lawfare. How do you actually sell all of this? This just gives you a little bit of an idea of Israel's military and security reach. I would argue that Israel has more military security police reach globally than the United States. People say, well, what are you talking about? The United States has $1 trillion a year defense budget. Defense. Military budget and security budget. The United States has 174 bases around the world. You know, the United States supplies 70% of the new weapons every year. How can little Israel have more of a reach than that? Partly because the American reach is kind of shallow. It's true they have bases, but you know American bases, you have them here. I mean, the Americans are in their McDonald's worlds and their bases, you know, and they're with each other, and you don't see them very often. They're there, but they're, you know, and they're flying around or doing whatever they're doing. Israel, on the other hand, has 2 bases, both in Muslim countries. It has a base in Azerbaijan, which is a very great jumping-off place if you want to attack Iran, and it has a base in Eritrea, some islands off Eritrea. But in general, Israel doesn't have bases. But what it does do, first of all, it has military relations. We know with at least 130 countries, and probably with more. I'm sure Israel has relations with Iran and Saudi Arabia. In ways that aren't publicized. So probably almost every country has military relations with Israel. But in addition to that, it penetrates deep into the society. So Israeli, there's Israeli advisors, not only Israeli, but Israel has, I think, much more of a spread in this area, where Israel trains the security forces of everybody. There's almost no country where Israel's not involved with the security forces, with the special operations forces, with the presidential guard of dictators. You know, Mobutu's presidential guard was trained by Israel. Mobutu got wings, paratroopers' wings. Idi Amin got paratroopers' wings from Israel. So the security forces, the police forces, and then, of course, VIP protection. You get Israeli military security policing deep, deep, deep into these societies, much deeper than the Americans go in. So I think in some ways Israel is the country that has the widest military security police reach. When it serves the hegemons, I'm not just talking about the global north or even the BRICS countries. I'm talking about every country. And if you look at the military spending of the 10 poorest countries in the world, look, you've got Congo, where the average income is $394 a year, and the Congo spends $300 million a year on weapons and security systems. So it's worthwhile being in the Congo. You know, we don't think about it, and we see it, but, you know, from the point of view of economics and clout, the Congo, even though it's poor, is significant in terms of military security. You know, and you can go, I mean, it's the same point. You know, countries that have, that are very poor, nevertheless spend a lot of money on the military and security. So one niche for Israel, then, is this whole thing of the military, supplying military. And I'm not going to go over this, but what I try to do in the book is actually set this out, because we on the left, the activists or people, we don't know anything about the military. Including, I mean, I'm not, you know, put me in. I couldn't tell you a howitzer from a tank. I don't know anything. But that's a real problem that we don't know. Because we don't know what we're facing. And we don't know how to develop strategies of resistance. And we don't have any idea the powers that we're trying to face in the world. And so what I try to do in my book is to lay out, just from the Israeli point of view, some of the military technologies that exist. So let's begin to, you know, I'm an anthropologist by profession. And we work with informants in a nice sense, not in the Shin Bet sense. And in a sense, you know, what I try to do in my book is I try to let the military explain to me what they're doing and what their concepts are and how they see their weapon systems and so on. And I try to lay that out in the book so that Israel is one of the seven countries of the world that has the capability of launching its own satellites. And it launches its satellites from either Azerbaijan or India. Israel has nine spy satellites in the world. It has a whole network of communications and spy satellites throughout the world. And just so you don't think this doesn't affect you, I read in the newspaper yesterday, Facebook paid $100 million to the Israeli company that runs this. Israel's going to put up what's called OFEC 10, the 10th of the series, in a couple months. And that will give Facebook access to Africa and to a lot of parts of the world that today don't have coverage from Facebook. Because it's a communication satellite, but a spy satellite as well. I mean, these two things go together. So that your Facebook has bought into Israeli spy satellites. There's all kinds of other satellites that Israel has. Intercontinental ballistic missiles. So Israel's ability to use missiles, it goes way beyond the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, here again, if you look at the Israeli arsenal, it has nothing to do with the Palestinians. I mean, Israel doesn't have Jericho intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear capabilities. And Israel has between 200 and 300 nuclear warheads. It refuses international inspections. It never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Everybody's focused on Iran. It doesn't have nuclear weapons. And look at Israel. Israel can hit Britain with its Jericho missiles. And it has nuclear missiles. You know, this brings us into a whole area way beyond the Palestinians. And that's why I'm looking at the global role of Israel. Israel develops, it's a small country, but it's developed its own jet fighter. It prefers to use the Americans. Because Israel becomes the testing ground for American weaponry. Israel is getting now a shipment of F-35s, these new stealth bombers, before the American Air Force does. Because it's better to have Israeli pilots test them than to have American pilots test them and crash. But Israel has developed its own jet fighters that it's selling to. It's used, but it's selling especially in Latin America. Also Sri Lanka. Taiwan is now probably going to buy them called the Kfir. It has a whole series of missiles, sea-to-sea missiles, surface-to-surface, surface-to-air, air-surface, all many of which have nuclear capabilities. And, in fact, Israel is now acquiring 9 nuclear-capable submarines from Germany, some of which are a gift to Germany, thank you very much, and some of them are kind of sold at a sale. Nuclear submarines aren't going to be used against Palestinians. So we're talking about an Israeli involvement in something much larger than simply Palestine. Israel can never produce a nuclear submarine like this. It just doesn't have the resources. It's a small country. But the electronic brains and the radar systems and the targeting systems and the firing systems of these submarines are Israeli. So what Germany does is it provides the shell, but it provides a tremendous economic and technical opportunity for Israel to develop cutting-edge high-tech components for weapon systems. For example, the F-35, Israel could never produce the new F-35, but the cockpit of the F-35 is largely Israeli. The avionics, the electronics, the firing systems are Israeli. Every air force in the world uses Israeli targeting pods for its missiles. Israel produces its own tank, and what it produces that's becoming very popular is a protective system for tanks and armored personnel carriers. I won't get into all. There's so much. And cyber warfare. Israel is one of the leaders. And matter of fact, Cameron referenced that the other day. Cameron said it's Israel's ability to wage cyber warfare that's protecting Britain. And then there's all kinds of things I get into the book that I want about future weapons. Things that we're not really aware of, like, for example, nanotechnologies. Israel is the world's leader in the military applications of nanotechnology. A nano is a billionth of a meter. It's the size of a molecule. So you can imagine what's called, for example, smart dust, which is if you're looking for somebody in Gaza or you're looking for somebody in London, you can program their DNA into a nanoparticle the size of dust. And you can spray it over a neighborhood, spray it over the city with a crop duster. Spray it over Gaza. It's invisible, basically. It's like dust. And it'll pick up the DNA. You can find that person in a minute. You can equip these smart dust with poisons. They're even developing micro cameras, Elbit systems in particular, that are almost nano. So you'll have spot. You can have invisible cameras all over. The cutting edge of military technology is called GNR, which is the combination of genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics. So imagine a nanobot, or swarm bots they're called, or nano warriors they're called, that are not much larger than a molecule, that can be enhanced with artificial intelligence. So that these nano warriors aren't programmed by us, but rather they have the ability to learn on their own, because this is enhanced artificial intelligence. And one nanobot, and they self-replicate, because, you know, you can't punch out nanorobots all day. They self-replicate. So one artificially intelligenced, enhanced nanobot with the ability to kill, one nanobot can replicate 3 trillion times in 3 hours. So we're talking about weapon systems that are beyond science fiction. And I've never seen a movie that featured nano dust. Smart dust, it's called sometimes. But at the same time, it's a dust that's smarter than we are. And the scientists are going, there's all kinds, I don't know if any of you are into all this, but there's some serious discussion about how do we defend ourselves against our own nanorobots. Because if you replicate three, we know in human replication, you get mutants. You get all kinds of mutations. So if a nanobot is replicating 3 trillion times, you're not going to get the same nanobot each time. So how do you prevent them from turning against us? You know, so they're talking about nano walls of nano warriors that will protect us against the nano warriors. I mean, the whole thing becomes crazy and paranoid and everything, but real. This is real stuff. It isn't simply science fiction. Here's DARPA that goes with the National Institute of Health and so on, and they have programs to integrate nano, bio, and info research. And one of their mottos is, in the future, every soldier will be a sensor. Another niche that's no less important, and this is really more important, the most important thing from my point of view, it's ability to conduct securocratic wars. This is just to kind of set this out in a certain context. When we think of war, we're usually talking about conventional interstate wars. But like I said, they're gone. There are no more, and there probably won't be, major interstate wars. So what we're talking about are a combination of what are called hybrid wars and securocratic wars. Hybrid wars are when, like Hezbollah, or Al-Qaeda, or ISIS, or the drug cartels in Mexico, what are basically non-state actors, what used to be called guerrilla forces, have access to high-tech modern weaponry. So it becomes a hybrid because it is partly conventional warfare. I mean, you know, they have missiles, they have, you know, maybe nuclear capabilities to some degree. There's all, you know, it's a very, you know, ISIS is holding its own against the global north and Russia. So it's not simply a matter of a few guerrilla warriors hiding out in caves and coming out at night and doing something. It's a hybrid war. And think of all the terms we use. We use words like the limited wars, small wars, asymmetrical wars, military operations other than war. That's a great term. And it's a great term because it lets you conduct war against people without extending to them the rights that prisoners of war or combatants have. You avoid the laws of warfare, which make the states, if you can do this, the states that are fighting wars like Britain, war criminals, basically. Because you've developed a kind of a mechanism for bypassing the laws of war, because it's not really a war. What is it? It's something other than war. High-intensity operations, police operations. So you have a whole phenomenon of the British Army that's really a police force today. What are you doing in Afghanistan? And places like that, in Libya. Not fighting wars. There's regime change, there's nation building, peacekeeping operations, policing operations, pacification. The wars are becoming police actions. And that has to do with the capitalist system as well. The pacification, as resources get scarcer, as there's more resistance, as more and more people are excluded, and so on, you've got to begin to have wars amongst the people, or as I say, wars against the people. And those are these kinds of hybrid wars. But then they get into what are called securocratic wars, which are fought in British cities. These are wars that are fought with, you know, because fear, you know, the whole thing now about all the Syrian refugees, you know, many of whom are Palestinians, being infiltrated with ISIS. You know, there's 4,000 ISIS refugees coming into Europe. So everybody, you see, this was a part of that breakdown of the inside-outside, especially it happened after 9/11, but even before, and that is that now the wars are internalized. We have immigrants, we have poor people, we have peoples of color, we've got the Occupy Wall Street, you've got even our own middle-class kids are becoming our enemies. All these internal, you know, and so in a way, war, you know, so the police are becoming militarized. The militaries are becoming policified, and the police are becoming militarized in the equipment they use and in their concepts. And one of the things that Israel trains as British police is that you're not protecting citizens, you're basically fighting potential enemies. Potential. You have to treat the public as potential terrorists, not as citizens. It's a whole change in concept. And so as it begins to get into the internal security, you begin to have, I mean, again, you know, you go through
guerrilla war zone, all that. But then you get into counterterrorism, crime and terrorism start to come together, homeland security, a permanent state of emergency. So that's the new normal. Now everything's a state of, well, in a state of emergency, everything's suspended. Laws are suspended, rights are suspended, and everything becomes securitized. That's exactly what Israel has over the Palestinians, a permanent emergency that allows it to do anything it wants to do. And if it can show countries like Britain how to impose that themselves, then in a sense, you know, we have a saying in the Israeli peace movement that we're all Palestinians. And by that, of course, we mean that in solidarity. But literally, we're all Palestinians in that we're all on the receiving end of the same kinds of weapons and concepts and campaigns, securitocratic campaigns, that the Palestinians have been subjected to. And that gets into policing and discipline. This is a Pentagon map of how the Pentagon views the world. You know, if you think this whole capitalist thing is kind of an old-fashioned term or some invention, you know, they talk about the core being basically the global north and what are called the BRICS countries. And then most of the humanity and most of the world is what's called the non-integrating gap. How's that for where a lot of you are from? The non-integrating gap. Now, what does the non-integrating gap contribute to the world? They don't contribute diamonds, oil, natural gas, timber, minerals, and so on. They contribute pandemics, narcotics, and terror. I mean, it sounds like Donald Trump is running the Pentagon. You know? So what do? You have to shrink the gap. How do you shrink the gap? By exporting security. How's that for a term? Exporting security. Now, who does a better job than Israel in terms of exporting security? To the worst security sinkholes. Whoa, how's that for a way to characterize most of the world as a security sinkhole? And when necessary, regime change, nation building. You see, it's all the policing again. The policing, security, terror. So, you know, this really is the way that a lot of the militaries and security people and government see the world. And so one of Israel's specialties are weapons of suppression and securocratic control, which means domestic control in cities, in police forces. And I won't get into it, but of course, drones. Israel is the world's leader in drone production and war. 40% of the drones in the world are Israeli. All kinds of weapons of suppression. You saw the Merkava tank Israel has. This is called the Merkava LIC. What's LIC? Low intensity conflict. This is what you use in Gaza, and then this is what you deploy in British cities when the need arises. American police forces have a lot of these Merkava LICs. All kinds of, again, remote control weaponry. I'm not going to get into all of this. Plus, being the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, certainly a weapon of suppression is a Caterpillar bulldozer that's used against the Palestinians. I mean, this is the D9 bulldozer, militarized, and Caterpillar bulldozers are sold to Israel as military products. You can see the size of them. I mean, the shovel is the size of a two-story building. This is a smaller one, but you can see the shovel is larger than a human. And the shovel is built in a way specifically for demolitions. When it hits a building in Gaza, for example, and if you look at the films of the invasions of Gaza, when they come from Israel and you have the column going into Gaza, it's led by a bulldozer, followed by a tank, followed by a bulldozer, followed by a tank, followed by a bulldozer. The bulldozers are as crucial in this as the tanks are because they clear the way, which means, in the case of Gaza last summer, demolishing 18,000 Palestinian homes in order to make way for the tanks and for the military. Well, if you have a normal bulldozer and you hit an apartment building, it's going to collapse on the driver. So the shovels are designed in a way with the Israeli army so that when it hits a building, the building falls away from the driver. So this is a powerful machine that's explicitly used for demolishing Palestinian homes. And this is the Jenin refugee camp in 2002 that was the victim of a whole series of D9 bulldozers that worked for 72 hours straight without stopping. And the bulldozer has, just to show you, a hook in the back, because it's also used to destroy infrastructure. So they go into Ramallah or Bethlehem or Tul Karm, and any city, and the hook is shoved into the pavement of the street. And then the bulldozer, which is a powerful machine, simply drives up and down the streets of Palestinian cities, ripping out the sewage systems, the electric cables, the telephone lines, the whole infrastructure of the city is destroyed. This is a weapon of suppression. And again, the whole language of security. If it's security, we're protecting ourselves against terrorists. That's the way an entire people is characterized. So it's the good guys that drive the cat against the bad guys. So you can see the whole thing is a system. I call it a pacification system that fits together. And there's all kinds of drones, including mini drones, the robotification of insects. There's a whole thing, robotic insects that get into nano. These are micro, they're bigger than nano, but nano weapons as well. I won't get into all of that. Plus all kinds of crowd control things and robots. Israel specializes in robots and getting down to SWAT teams and police forces. And we're talking about, there's a whole institute at MIT that's connected with Technion in Israel for what are called soldier nanotechnologies. Part of what I'm just trying to do in this book and in my lecture is simply to begin to raise the consciousness toward this, because if we don't integrate this into our political analysis as people on the left, who are politically active, then, you know, we're talking about irrelevant things. We've got to really become much more sophisticated. I'm not going to get into the whole matrix control. There's a whole other thing. Never mind. But just one last thing, and that is that this whole issue of framing, because that's also a part, a specialty of Israel. How does it get away with it? Not only get away with it in terms of the military, political support, the occupation, but if you go out in the streets, I mean, I know there's been a change in public opinion, but if you go out into the street, Israel still enjoys quite a bit of support among the people out there. You know, it's seen as fighting terrorism. You know, the Arabs are terrorists. All that kind of. How does that happen? After all these years, when the facts are out and the films are out, it shows you the power of framing. That Israel's framing, ability to frame and get us thinking with a certain language that prejudices the way we approach problems, is also something that it exports. Here's a picture after Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09 in Gaza, the attack on Gaza. The spokesperson of the Chinese army comes to Israel. This is the IDF spokesman to learn how Israel sold Operation Cast Lead. Because if the Chinese can learn how to sell the repression of Tibet, or of its Muslim minorities to the world, that's a great thing. So that it's all kinds of levels to this whole thing. You know, he operates drones during the day and lights Hanukkah candles at night. Isn't that nice? And Israel has a whole project that it calls the Lawfare Project. That's very strong in the UK, actually, as well, in which it's trying to change international law. So, for example, one of the principles in international law is that you're forbidden to kill civilians or harm civilians in warfare, non-combatants. So Israel says, look, we're dealing with terrorists. We can't. They're not wearing uniforms. We have to change the law that anybody is a fair target, so that the Israeli exporting of its occupation and the way it treats the Palestinians really presents a threat to civil liberties in countries like Britain. What I'm trying to do in my work, look, I'm approaching 70. I don't have time for long processes. I kind of want to jump to the bottom line. The problem is the capitalist system that we live in. And we can fix this and that and have a campaign. You know, we're always, you know, against something with the environment and something with women and something with the developing world and something with this. But it's all piecemeal. We're not approaching the logic and the structural violence and so on of transnational capital. Part of that logic has to do with this, all this military security stuff that we've been talking about and the weaponry that have a tremendous impact in our lives. It's a blind spot on the left. We never talk about this stuff. The military security is not an issue on the left, hardly at all. So I'm trying to raise consciousness so that if we can begin to introduce a more critical view, then military operations will be seen as irrelevant, which they are. War amongst the people, rather than securitizing us, is actually repressive. And in terms of a security-based framing, what we have to re-articulate, reframe what kind of a world system we want, and then begin to try to develop what I call going from the hegemony of transnational capital through this violent system, and to try to get down into what I call, at least, a human-centric hegemony. What is that? And we haven't articulated that very well. So that I'm really looking at this as kind of a way of beginning a discussion that can actually lead to big ideas of counter-hegemony. Not simply, deal with Afghanistan, and let's deal with Somalia, let's deal with some neighborhood in London or something, in a piecemeal way, but how do we really deal with the whole system?
Now we continue with the Q&A.
Could you tell us a bit more about Israel and its use, or if it's at all involved with biological chemical weapons?
No, Israel has a whole range of weapons. Nuclear, biological, chemical. The biological and chemical warfare manufacturing and development is in a place called Nes Ziona, which is a town not far from Tel Aviv. Israel has chemical weapons, biological weapons, and the biological weapons, of course, get into nanotechnology as well. But for example, just to give you one little tiny example, and that is that nanoweaponry is really, in many ways, biological weaponry. Nanotechnology has a very benevolent... If you go out, the people like nanotechnology because it's associated with biomedicine. So if you have circulatory problems, you can put a nano gauge in your blood vein that measures your blood flow, and it's a good thing. But all these are byproducts of the military, because the military is the source of these technologies, really. And part of the nanotechnology capability, for example, with this smart dust, you can program this dust to incapacitate an entire population. You can attack a population's Gaza. You can attack a population's nervous system by nanobots that infiltrate into the body and contaminate the blood system or certain organs. You can use, and they're developing, you can use nanotechnology to affect the mind. You can take an entire population and make it forget. You can hit particular parts of the brain. You can take an entire population and make them laugh uncontrollably. In other words, nanotech, and it's really invisible stuff. So I think these sorts of things are getting into forms of biological and chemical warfare that are much more dangerous and pervasive than the older forms. And Israel is really one of the leaders.
Jeff, I was almost convinced there through that talk that you must be on the sales team of the...
I know.
of the Israeli industry, but...
Somebody said that to me the other day. Sounds great. Where do I sign?
But your very important question of how does Israel get away with it? It really is the elephant in the room, the answer, isn't it? I mean, can we put anything on Malcolm X's? And I've got the quote here so that I don't misquote him. The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and make the guilty innocent. They control the minds of the masses. Malcolm X. Right.
But without getting into that, part of that has to do with what I was calling framing. Reframing, because the media needs to be also trained in the use of words. What are buzzwords? What are words that mislead you? Because not all the journalists are so clever. And that's really one of the specialties of Israel, is to feed journalists with a kind of a language that blames the victims and leaves the powerful off the hook. Brian, yes.
Thank you. I was having a friendly argument with a comrade the other day, and he was maintaining that Israel, like the USSR, would collapse. And nobody predicted, even the criminologists never predicted the use of it. And I quoted various things from your book. I said, look, they're going all somewhere. There will be some time in the people are very clever. So is there any chance that the whole thing collapse?
ironically, I mean, maybe I'm contradicting myself, but I think yes. I think there is an Achilles heel. And that, again, is the Palestinians. And one of the reasons I'm writing this is to look, I couldn't present, and it's true, I have to really think of how I'm presenting this. I don't want to leave the impression that it's all sewn up, and that we're all losing, and they're all powerful. These are totalizing weapons, and we might as well just submit. That's the whole idea of what I'm trying to say, is in order for us to resist and to get to a real counter-hegemony and a new system, we've got to know what we're facing. And we have, you know, in order to develop really effective tactics. So in a sense, I'm trying to empower us to resist rather than... and I think the Palestinians show that as well. I mean, with all this technology we're talking about, everything, Israel has not pacified the Palestinians. I mean, even today, if you look at what's happening in the last week or two, the resistance is going on. I think Palestinians have been effective in, to some degree, in changing public opinion. You have BDS movements. In other words, there's still that element of resistance that's I think it has to be more effective and it has to be more strategic in a way. So from my point of view, Israel, the whole thing could collapse. Not so much Israel, but the whole situation, in my view, if the Palestinian Authority leaves the scene. As long as the PA is there with Abu Mazen and these guys, nothing's going to happen. I mean, the Palestinians are living under two occupations. And I think what could happen, and it's between analysis and wishful thinking, with what's going on today, it's not that necessarily it's a third intifada, what's happening on the ground, but that the resistance and the violence that's generated, especially by young Palestinians, will create such an overreaction on the part of Israel. Because Israel has to prove to the world that it's pacifying the Palestinians. I mean, it undercuts their whole marketing. If the Palestinians are able to resist with rocks... The whole IDF that's trying to tell the world that we know the way that you can pacify everybody. So a lot is riding on the pacification of the Palestinians. And I think what could happen, in one scenario is that Israel would so overreact that it would finally push Abu Mazen over the edge. And the guy would resign, or the PA would collapse. I mean, the PA is seen as a collaborationist regime by its own people. And if the PA is out of the way, then I think you've got an untenable situation on the part of Israel. You've got millions of Palestinians impoverished, no infrastructure. I don't think the United States and Europe would pick up that slack. You'd have chaos, you'd have violence. I think it would inflame the Arab and Muslim and worlds, but beyond that as well. And I think that the collapse of the PA, that could happen soon, inshallah, would be a game changer. So that, again, you know, it's like, you look at the United States and all these, you know, look at the Soviet Union. I mean, they were all powerful, powerful countries with these militaries, but with feet of clay. And in the end, you know, these big powers tend to collapse. And I think that's going to happen in the Israeli case. I think it's an untenable situation. But in the meantime, of course, Israel has a tremendous impact outside.
I'm glad you said that and you talk about resistance, because I very much think that what you're doing is extremely important. I totally agree with your last point that we shouldn't be paralysed by the apparent omnipotence of the new technologies.
That's right.
And I'd be interested to know kind of your comments on the difference between the situation in the region now in 2015 and what we saw in 2011. We had mass popular uprisings across the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you mentioned Egypt. Now, as you said, Egypt is one of the strongest backers of Israel in the region. The Egyptian regime went through an enormous crisis because of ordinary people going into the streets, using non-violent, largely, methods of protest, although there was some, I think, rightly targeted violence at the machinery of repression itself. Now, that revolution was defeated, but I think the Palestinian resistance can play a really important role in, potentially, in the longer term, the revival of that kind of movement. And I just wanted to briefly say to people quickly that Abdel Fattah Sisi the Egyptian president is supposed to be coming to London. He's been invited officially by David Cameron. And so if people want to know some information about the campaign against his visit, then please come and pick up leaflets afterwards. And I would invite anyone here who's involved with Palestine Society, with BDS, to come and have a protest against that, because this, in terms of house demolition, Sisi has been flattening Rafah from the Egyptian part. So, you know, the struggle has to be made up.
A lot of it has to do with security politics, again, because two countries very close to each other, besides Egypt and Israel, are Israel and Saudi Arabia. And here, in terms of normal politics, I mean, that's crazy. Saudi Arabia is the mother and father of Al-Qaeda and certain types of Islamic fundamentalism, and it's certainly not pro-Zionist, and again. But remember back in 2002, you had the what was called the Arab Peace Initiative, which is also called the Saudi Peace Initiative. Saudi Arabia is the one that pushed through the Arab League unanimously this offer to Israel that we'll all make peace with you if you give up the occupation, basically. And Israel, of course, said no, but I think there was a subtext to that. And I think the subtext was Saudi Arabia was saying to Israel, we want you to be the regional hegemon, because if you take away the Palestinians, and the Palestinians aren't seen sympathetically by a lot of the Arab world, and certainly the governments of the Arab world either. I mean, they're seen as a threat. But if you take away all that conflict, Israel has almost identical interests with the conservative Arab regimes. I mean, Israel sent crowd control materials to the Egyptian regime when it was putting down the Arab Spring, for example. You know, it needs Israel against Iran, against the Shiite forces and so on. But it also needs Israel in a securocratic way against its own peoples. So that's a really good example of how security is translated into hegemony. Because, ironically, it's the Arab world, or the conservative Arab world, let's say, that wants Israel to be the hegemon, rather than having the Arab-Israeli conflict. So another, I think the difference is the Arab-Israeli conflict took place at a time when Israel didn't have that much clout, and there was more of an ideological kind of attention. But the minute Israel began to acquire this military securocratic clout, that changed the whole, now we want them to be our friends, and so on. So it's a good example of how everything turns on its head.
I'd just like to ask, when the IDF and then the spokespeople, they come out and say that they're frightened on forces like Hezbollah, do they really mean it? Is it part of their framing method? Or are they genuinely terrified of what of what groups like Hezbollah are capable of? Because after 2006, or during 2006 even, during that war, I think the IDF they caught quite off guard.
Right.
And they're very surprised at what they encountered. Some of the tanks that you showed, the Hezbollah managed to destroy a few of them. And
right.
And since then, they have sort of upped their rhetoric about how dangerous and capable Hezbollah are as a force.
I think a lot of that is hype, because I think you know, Israel's trying to build up its adversaries, and so when it knocks them down, it makes much more of an impression. For example, one of the outcomes of the 2006 war in Lebanon, what was called the Dahiya Doctrine, that I write about in the book, where the IDF, the Israeli Air Force in particular, attacked the neighborhood of Dahiya in Beirut, which is kind of the stronghold or the center of the Hezbollah in Beirut. In the laws of war, in the Fourth Geneva Convention, and in different laws of war, you're not allowed to use disproportional force, certainly against the civilian population. And Israel basically said, Hezbollah is such a danger, but it's a danger not in terms of Hezbollah itself, but in terms of representing the kinds of non-state actors that the global north and all these elites are faced with. That's kind of the danger. That we need new rules to deal with them. And so you build them up in a way so that now you can justify the Dahiya Doctrine. Unless you kill them all and respond in a completely disproportionate way, they're going to win. So you're using them, and you're using security as a way of justifying what are really illegal war crimes, basically. So that Israel applied the Dahiya Doctrine to Gaza in the subsequent invasions of Gaza, and then it added to the Dahiya Doctrine what's called the Hannibal procedure, which you saw in Gaza. So that and through the lawfare campaign. It's trying, again, to get the UN and get countries to change the laws. So I think Israel kind of, I think it sort of hypes and builds up these forces because that's the way they can justify not their own. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's bigger than Hezbollah. It has to do with the whole range of non-state actors that the global north is trying to fight. So that what you have to do is not only develop weapons to beat Hezbollah. That's not so hard. They could beat Hezbollah in terms of, I mean, this. The main thing is, how do you create a legal system, I think, that allows armies to unleash the power it has? Well, the problem that Israel has with Hezbollah and the Palestinians is it's constrained to some degree by international law, by the issue of war crimes. You know, Netanyahu comes to London and 100,000 people sign a petition to have him arrested. You've got to change. That's the danger, you see. So in a sense, to create a situation where the states have the absolute unfettered ability to attack and kill anybody they want to, you use Hezbollah as a kind of a straw man to set up that situation, and then by justifying it through Hezbollah, then you can spread it and apply it to other places. It's kind of Hezbollah writ large.
Language, the misuse and the double speak.
Right.
Why does it always come across as American?
American?
No, you see what I mean? Some of the words you've used and you've explained how they've been twisted, it always comes across as American. Why?
I don't understand the question.
You've used the word security.
Right.
And you defined how its definition has been twisted.
And but Cameron twists as much as,
okay,
as Obama does.
But there's been lots of other words which right. have come out, and they will all come out as American, and I can't understand this. Is there an Israeli institute in America to devise these formulate words?
Yes, actually there is. There's a guy, you can look it up, there's a guy named Fred Lutz, yes, who's the main speech propagandist for the Republican Party. He's the one that develops things like... you know, when you're attacking women and abortion and women's rights and so on, you call it family values. You see, he's and he has a dictionary. I mean, it's on the internet. There's a dictionary that you use when you're defending Israel. How do you frame the conflict in a way that Israel comes out good, the Palestinians come out bad, and so on? And it's a very thought out.
What's his name again?
Fred Lutz, Lutz. And, you know, he works very closely with AIPAC and works very closely with the Republican Party. He's advising Trump. I don't know how good he's doing with Trump. But he's, and so, yeah, there is an industry that does that. And, of course, it's connected to advertising. I mean, you've got, you know, Israel hires PR firms all over the world. The whole thing of pinkwashing, where Tel Aviv becomes the capital of gay culture in the world. You see how liberal we are. Calendars or Esquire magazines that have women soldiers in khaki bikinis on the beach in Tel Aviv carrying guns. I mean, they're very sophisticated in the manipulation of images and so on. And so it isn't just a kind of a happenstance thing. I think it is a very thought-out type of framing part of the campaign.
Given that Israel is such a massive exporter of macro-nano security,
right,
to what extent do you think that Israel is nevertheless a tool of American hegemony, and how much is it an independent hegemon in its own right?
It's not so much a hegemon in its own right, I think. It's still a small country. But I don't think it's a tool. I think it serves. Like I said, it serves the hegemons. So it identifies. It isn't a tool in the sense that it's... doing something it doesn't want to do, or that the United States is telling it, it's proactively telling the United States what it has to do in order to keep its hegemony. You see, so there is a kind of a partnership there in a sense, but you know, Israel also has, and I write about this as well, its own agency. It's very clever, I have to say. I mean, I sound like I'm some pro-Israeli guy now, but for example, you know, the enemy of the United States today is China. I mean, China is really what the United States is concerned about. And I think before ISIS, I think what the United States was looking to do was to try to get out of the Middle East and do what was called, what's called the Asian pivot. Yeah. It's moved the whole Sixth Fleet into the Pacific. China is its real concern. Well, who's the number two arms supplier to China? It's Israel. This wonderful ally of the United States. Netanyahu is every 3 days talking to the American Congress. Israel is, and during Bush, the son's presidency, George W., the deputy secretary of defense was a guy named Richard Perle, who was one of the Jewish neocons, very much, for American hegemony and using Israel and so on. But when Israel started to sell Falcon surveillance planes to using American technology to China, Richard Perle threatened that the United States would cut diplomatic ties with Israel. That was a degree to which Israel was really compromising America, because it was transferring American technology to China. And that was that sort of, for a Jewish neocon, Israel became a threat. So you can imagine. So what I'm saying is Israel has its own agendas as well. And I think, people ask me, what would Israel do if the United States ever abandoned it? I think the opposite is more likely. I think, when Israel sees a change where the BRICS countries begin to rise, and China begins to rise, and the United States, is faltering and so on, man, Israel could switch horses in a minute. Kissinger used to have a saying, the countries don't have friends, they have interests. And I think that Israel is very, very much very calculated, and it plays both sides. It gets close to Pakistan to some degree, but it's very close to India. If you look at Israel as a case study of how a little country manipulates and does security stuff and fills niches and all of that, it's really very revealing in terms of how this Machiavellian kind of a world works, more than if you're looking at Britain or the United States.
And there's one more question, but I deleted that for time. I shall post the entire interview at unwelcomeguest.net/728. We continue with a reading of an academic paper. This is in the journal Surveillance and Society, and it was published this year by lecturer Ben Harbisher. The title is Unthinking Extremism, Radicalizing Narratives That Legitimize Surveillance. And it's written for an academic audience, so I'm going to summarize my understanding of it. If you wished to control a society through a strategy of tension, carrying out terrorist acts where needed to pacify a population, how would you do that? Well, you'd need to have some well-trained and well-hidden terrorists. Well, we've just looked at Operation Gladio. One of the problems you would have would be these institutions, such as law and order, would keep getting in the way, saying, hey, we've got a crime committed here. I wonder what we've got in the way of evidence. Let's use some of our detective forces to try and see what's going on, and if necessary, put these people in jail. Well, that, of course, is what happened, and that's why Gladio was exposed. So perhaps you had another program, let's call it Gladio B, and you thought, how can we prevent that problem from recurring? One way could be to have a totally separate group of institutions with a special remit called terrorism. If they were allowed in certain circumstances to override the normal procedure, so you didn't, for example, have to present a legal case against bin Laden, you just said, we're the terrorist experts and we know bin Laden did it, that would save a lot of potential difficulty in courts. You might wish to not have a particularly clear remit about exactly what was going on, so you might want to, say, couple this to some fairly fuzzily defined terms, and you might want to work on the flexibility of these terms. Perhaps you could begin by talking about Muslim extremists. If you owned the corporate media system, you might be very tempted to over-report and emphasize the Muslim angle of terrorism, as has happened, as we've heard. Then you could gradually start to change, just talk about extremists. Then maybe you could talk about domestic or homegrown extremists or homegrown terrorists, and gradually Could you, by doing this, changing the use patterns over time, get people to associate any kind of dissent and disagreement with public stories told by government and the corporate media as extremism? Well, this is my interpretation. I'm going beyond what the author says in the paper, but I'm not describing a hypothetical set of institutions that might be set up. These are called fusion centres in the paper, and they do appear to have been rolled out across Western Europe, at least North America and many other countries. And we're going to hear some of their defining characteristics. And what really interests me is how this is shaped to the language which is being introduced, as if there is a small group of people, perhaps the top echelons of the counter-terrorism team, who understand that their job will include terrorism on occasions, because without terrorism there is no counter-terrorism, and they work for a paycheck. Then you have larger swathes of people in other institutions, older institutions, who haven't understood that, for example, 9/11 was an inside job. How could you not understand that? Well, if your salary depended on not understanding it, that would be a barrier. But most people simply aren't that venal in the case of something like 9/11. So this needs to be buttressed by a supporting framework of frames, vocabulary, as well as media exposure. It all works together. It's a totality to help people put two and two together and get five. And the quote of Malcolm X about the power of the media is quite apposite. And let's not do their job for them. Let's be aware at least that phrases such as war on terror, the global struggle against violent extremism, domestic extremism, these are categories and phrases which have been very much worked on to achieve the ends of the people behind those who did the work. I will say no more because I want to have as much of this paper as possible. I'm aware that it's written for an academic audience. I'm not a sociology professor, so I had to listen to this several times to really get the most out of it, and I should think the same is possibly quite likely also true for you. If you're listening on the radio and you'd like to download it, of course you can do so, as always, at its separate page. This is unwelcomeguest.net/728. And as a bonus, I will make the full paper downloadable via audio, even if I can't include this in the show due to time limits. Unthinking extremism. Radicalizing narratives that legitimize surveillance. By Ben Harbisher of De Montfort University. Abstract. The aim of this paper is to determine how Britain's public authorities, the intelligence community, and key members from the private sector have come to define common activists as terrorists. In short, newfound terms such as extremism have been popularized to condemn the activities of groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Islamic State, but at the same time they have been liberally applied to campaigners for the, quote, far less politically correct deterrence of dissenting public discourse, unquote. This paper therefore agrees that with the application of terms such as extremists to Britain's campaigners, these signifiers have notably radicalized protest groups, not by virtue of their actions per se, but by way of the very deliberate repositioning of activists within counter-terrorism frameworks and national security discourse. Comparatively, this paper provides a response to Monaghan and Wolby's 2012 call for further research into how terror identities have become organizing rubrics which define how threats to national security are identified and shape the responses from local government and regional stakeholders to such problems. In this respect, the paper considers a number of policing operations, public policies, and the introduction of a strategic dialogue through the West designed to provoke a unilateral response to terrorism, extremism, and radicalization. Introduction. Some of the most recent debates in surveillance studies have examined the rise of multi-agency security organizations throughout North America that have become known as DHS Fusion Centers, that's Department of Homeland Security, identified by Monaghan, Newkirk, Monaghan and Walby as being composed of local authorities, police agencies, security organizations, and members of the private sector. There were over 70 such centers operating in the U.S. alone by 2014. The fusion centers were established by the Department for Homeland Security following recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission's report into the lack of a cohesive security infrastructure in America leading up to the attacks on New York in 2001. DHS fusion centers were intended to serve as early warning networks to identify terrorist threats to the U.S. and coordinate a timely response to potential terrorist assaults. According to Monaghan and Palmer, the Department for Homeland Security, quote, absorbed and restructured 22 federal agencies, unquote, from 2003 onward, and now constitute well over 70 such groups across North America. While descriptions of fusion centers vary from one case to another, there are a number of commonalities which remain cogent throughout. Firstly, they are hybrid intelligence centers, which fuse together public-private partnerships. They operate at federal and regional levels and share a pool of resources, although they receive central direction for their efforts under DHS administration. Fusion centers are responsible for the local delivery of national counterterrorism initiatives for the territories in which they operate, even though the scope of these activities includes other business areas as well. Notably, as their membership is relatively broad, not restricted to one administrative office or organization, they hold the capacity to gather vast amounts of data from both public and private reserves. According to the Department for Homeland Security, quote, located in states and major urban areas throughout the country, fusion centers are uniquely situated to empower frontline law enforcement, public safety, fire service, emergency response, public health, critical infrastructure protection, and private sector security personnel to lawfully gather and share threat-related information, unquote. In relative terms, this means that fusion centers have the capacity to tap into telecommunication streams, public transport records, state-run or privately owned automated number plate recognition systems, CCTV footage, and many other sources of intelligence gathered from public archives. Indeed, this is situated explicitly for the purposes of providing an interagency response to terrorism-related matters, and to enable a better policing service for preventing serious organized crime. Nevertheless, what remains new about fusion centers is their relative autonomy from central government, working instead at a federal level and basing their operations on local jurisdictional matters. Furthermore, having received government startup grants in a number of cases, they've become self-sufficient quangos that possess a comparative degree of independence from the state. However, an alarming trend in the uses to which fusion center surveillance is being put relates to the ambiguity of their activities, to respective oversight limitations, and to the expansion of their interests into other areas that do not necessarily equate to terrorism. As Torin Monaghan notes below, the mission creep of America's fusion centers has steadily ventured into a number of domains which have very little or nothing at all to do with the war on terror. Quote, the primary goal of fusion centers is to engage in intelligence sharing for counter-terrorism purposes. However, they have been used for a variety of other purposes, such as basic policing, spying on social movement organizations, or restricting legal public activities, such as taking photographs. Unquote. While significant attention should be paid to the changes that these institutions have brought about, especially in the context of policing activities, mass surveillance, and for matters of public administration, of greater concern is their capacity to create new risk categories which follow the same form and level of threat as mass casualty acts of terror. As suggested by Monaghan and Wolby, modern intelligence agencies have blurred the categories of terrorism, extremism, and activism into an aggregate threat matrix. Indeed, this has also been noted by the British government, who stated in a 2009 review of national security policy that in the war against terror, quote, the lines between terrorism, subversion, and legitimate dissent and protest may become increasingly blurred, unquote. And this has most certainly been the case for Canada, the United States, and in the UK. The new terror identities that have been created in response to this aggregate threat matrix are depicted in their Canadian context as being acts of multi-issue extremism, or rather, as MIEs. However, beyond the above conceptualization of the term, the notion of multi-issue extremism has been used extensively by the Canadian authorities since at least 2008, with a number of variations seen throughout the Western Hemisphere in recent years. In this respect, online activist group Statewatch has reported that, quote, in June 2010, the US, EU, and its member states issued a declaration on counter-terrorism which called for an effective and comprehensive approach to diminish the long-term threat of violent extremism, and highlighted the importance of countering the threat of homegrown violent extremism and of sharing of lessons learned and best practices. Respectively, both the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, and the Integrated Threat Assessment Centre, ITAC, make reference to such classifications in public-facing reports on the nation's strategic response to terrorism. It can be claimed, then, that the deployment of terms such as multi-issue extremists, or even multi-issue groups, illustrates a change in thinking from perceiving terrorism as something ordinarily undertaken by radical actors from overseas to the pursuit and prevention of domestic or political threats instigated by dissidents from within the homeland. MIEs are therefore designed to provoke an equivalent national security response to terror attacks, far-left and right-wing acts of extremism, and for politically motivated campaigns that use direct action as a means to facilitate dissenting public discourse. But most worryingly of all, they're being imposed upon legitimate protest groups, irrespective of First Amendment or European human rights laws. In this respect, Monaghan comparatively states that, quote, fusion centres have also been implicated in scandals involving covert infiltrations of non-violent groups, including peace activist groups, anti-death penalty groups, animal rights groups, Green Party groups, and others, unquote. Although the threat of international terrorism remains a very real and pressing matter for all members of modern society, a sidebar comment from me, traffic accidents kill hundreds of times as many people as terrorists. Back to the text, the combination of interests and values represented by fusion centres in the US has enabled these networks to stigmatise and surveil protest groups who pose an economic threat to their stakeholders. In the run-up to the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics, for example, ITAC ran a campaign to discredit amalgamated opposition to the Games under the No Olympics on Stolen Native Land banner. This indicates that fusion centres such as ITAC deliberately confiscate and reinvent security classifications to meet financial or political aims, especially where core members of these intelligence communities are local contractors or sponsors of the events in question. So not only do fusion centres represent a blurring of the lines between terrorism and legitimate dissent, but they also highlight a conflict of interests between the state, its corporate associates, and their subjects, by defining domestic threats on an equivalent scale to international terrorism. To further this concern, Wolby notes that the reclassification of campaign groups, such as MIEs, was legitimised by risks perceived to the provision of domestic utilities, economic institutions, and commercial operations in Vancouver 2010. Indeed, such factors remain central to how counter-terrorism discourse is being mobilised to align acts of terror with public protest throughout many Western states. This can be seen especially in the UK, in which language concerning critical public infrastructure has been used to legitimise the surveillance of campaigners and the mobilisation of multi-million pound public order actions by the police. This paper therefore argues that MIE terror identities are not unique to Canada or the US, but instead form part of a wider international effort to initiate cross-border security networks, share relevant information among the intelligence community, and disseminate key strategic solutions to acts of terrorism and multi-issue extremism. Indeed, the ultimate aim of such practices is to rationalize all forms of extremism, including public acts of dissent, for their capacity to incite civil unrest via the disruption of state-sanctioned activities. And this is where I removed the middle third of the paper, I'm afraid, but we pick up with the concluding sections. In a similar respect, the RICU was set up exclusively to provide a consistent and strategic response to the threat of terrorism by regulating all public-facing communications. In other words, the RICU determines what messages are to be received by the general public and how such discourses might then be interpreted. The shift from GWAT to GSAVE, as articulated by the RICU, repackaged terrorists as being violent extremists for the simple fact that using terms such as a conflict of cultures or jihad reiterates anti-Western sentiment. It was considered that these particular ideas were among the main factors adding to the legitimacy of terrorist acts and would otherwise lead susceptible individuals towards radicalization. As a result of the wider dissemination of key counter-terrorism narratives in the UK, mainly through public sector and domestic media outlets, the RICU has gained a vast and unsuspecting audience. In what became known as Britain's Strategic Dialogue Against Terrorism, contest stakeholders, such as local government authorities, members of local and national industry and the police, deliver GSAVE narratives to the general public. By virtue of the British Constabulary's remit to prevent acts of terrorism, the strategic dialogue has also become a useful tool for legitimising public order actions as well, particularly in relation to acts of multi-issue extremism. Now, from the UK government's strategy for countering international terrorism, quote, "We may face challenges from non-state actors, whether motivated by ideology or not, who employ the methods and tactics of terrorists, but do not conform to historical models of terrorist groups." Unquote. Therefore, the terminology of GSAVE came to encompass undesirable activities against the state, under the banner of prevent, and euphemized insubordinate political interests as being potential acts of terrorism. Under prevent, terrorists became violent extremists and, as of 2004, direct action activists became known as domestic extremists. While this may seem a tertiary definition at best, the power which can be summoned from this term is now undeniable, as with Wolby and Monaghan's notion of MIE in its Canadian context. Domestic extremism is simply Britain's version of an MIE discourse within a comparative aggregate threat matrix. Indeed, according to the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, domestic or multi-issue extremists remain a very serious threat to the Canadian state and are regarded on a comparative level to Islamic extremists. So, how does such a term find political agency if the government has published a volumetric account of material on the subject in the public domain? Well, in the first instance, all of the public sector and private interests who identify and mitigate risks to the broader population have come to use it, ostensibly for the wider condemnation of activists as extremists, but far more conventionally to criminalise the activities of terrorists. Indeed, this is notably how the term has been popularised by Britain's fusion intelligence centres in what can otherwise be determined as the mission creep of counter-terrorism doctrine in the UK. Moreover, evidence suggests that Britain's emergency planners regularly make use of the strategic dialogue when defining political and environmental actions, and it's the sheer regularity of the term from which it derives its potency. According to the Guardian newspaper, in 2009, quote, "The term domestic extremism is now common currency within the police. It's a phrase which shapes how forces seek to control demonstrations. It's led to personal details and photographs of a substantial number of protesters being stored on secret police databases around the country. Senior officers describe domestic extremists as individuals or groups that carry out criminal acts of direct action in furtherance of a campaign. These people and activities usually seek to prevent something from happening or to change legislation or domestic policy, but attempt to do so outside of the normal democratic process." Unquote. Most recently still, the City of London Police has been accused of using the strategic dialogue to undermine anti-capitalism protesters in the UK's capital. In a letter circulated to members of London's business district, police warned traders to remain vigilant following a series of terrorist attacks. The communication informed them of three high-profile assaults that were likely to have repercussions around the world, and cited the most substantial risks to those in the city as being posed by international groups from the Republican interests in Ireland. The memorandum contained an account of militarist incursions in Pakistan, Belarus, and Solano by factions such as Al-Qaeda and the Revolutionary Forces of Colombia. But what was most surprising was that the document held a relatively small group of demonstrators who were camped out on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral as posing the greatest threat of all to British society. The following letter typifies how domestic and violent forms of extremism are depicted as being part and parcel of the same MIE problem. Despite a nominal attempt by police to differentiate between international and domestic concerns, the terrorism extremism update situates both public order and international affairs within the same MIE narrative, because terrorism equates to extremism, and extremism can be used to describe any form of dissenting public action or violent activity. The question over this operational ambiguity also forms the focus for this paper, for the deliberate blurring of lines between terrorism, subversion, and legitimate dissent are the radicalizing narratives that have come to legitimize surveillance. It is essential, then, to re-examine the concept of a multi-issue extremism, for under the remit of contest, Britain's strategic dialogue seeks to stigmatize campaigners before any offense has been committed. Indeed, under the UK's Terrorism Act 2000, counter-terrorism programs such as Contest, Prevent and Resilience depict animal rights activists as being terrorists. Evidence to corroborate this claim can be found in the UK government publication Animal Welfare Human Rights, which typifies the way that Britain's public authorities aim to discredit campaigners. In this respect, according to the Home Office, the activities of animal rights activists are, quote, considered to be acts of terrorism, unquote. Indeed, the government's thinking on this matter quite clearly states that, quote, animal rights extremists are organized in a quasi-terrorist cellular structure across the country, unquote, thus legitimizing links between political action and terrorism. Nevertheless, it's not merely animal rights and anti-capitalist activists who are being discredited as extremists under the UK's counter-terrorism laws. For a good number of single-issue, human and civil rights and multi-issue causes have also been subjected to similar levels of scrutiny and police intervention. But it's important to understand both how and why such groups have been positioned within these counter-terrorism frameworks in relation to the values they oppose. Civil contingency planning and resilience. Britain's institutional affair with risk-aversion politics began in 2001 with the introduction of the Civil Contingencies Secretariat, the CCS, which was designed to assume a number of roles previously conducted by the Home Office. The CCS was principally formed to moderate significant risks such as those posed by international terrorist groups, and those which may arise as a result of cataclysmic industrial incidents. Yet it was also intended to ensure the ongoing services and political integrity of centralized government, which aligns its particular area of expertise with managing volatile or subversive threats to society. In terms of crisis management, the Civil Contingency Secretariat works alongside collaborative partners such as the police, the security services, the Office for Security and Counter-Terrorism, to develop resilient scenarios for a number of proposed threats to the UK. Part of the initial role for the Civil Contingency Secretariat was to define a number of institutions and operational systems without which the nation would become vulnerable to attack. The Secretariat's examination of national security protocols resulted in the Civil Contingencies Act of 2004. The Civil Contingencies Act replaced obsolete programs with civil defence and provided new legislative grounds from which a state of national emergency could be declared, such as the Civil Defence Act of 1948. Under the Act, a number of stakeholders would come to define the greatest threats to their constituencies in a similar context to the DHS fusion centres. Key members from both the public and private sectors became officially responsible for maintaining local risk registers in which any perceived threats to their actions were identified and kept under close surveillance. According to the British government, these regional dossiers are compiled into a nationwide dossier. In 2015, they stated, quote, "The National Risk Register of Civil Emergencies provides an updated government assessment of the likelihood and potential impact of a range of different civil emergency risks, including naturally and accidentally occurring hazards and malicious threats, that may directly affect the UK. It also provides information on how the UK government and local respondents, such as emergency services, prepare for these emergencies." Unquote. Under the Civil Contingencies Act, the grounds upon which a state of national emergency could be declared include risks to the provision of power, the supply of food or money, and the distribution of petroleum products. Ostensibly, this criminalizes environmentalists and anti-globalization campaigners who try to disrupt such vital services, and posits them within Britain's national security framework as domestic or multi-issue extremists. In comparison to Monaghan and Wolby's earlier considerations regarding Canada's critical public infrastructure, the notion of protecting Britain's critical national infrastructure has astounding similarities, especially where public dissent now constitutes a form of extremism. The Civil Contingencies Act enabled Britain's governing authorities to establish a series of networks that fused together both private and public interests who identify and mitigate the risks posed to each individual catchment. Britain's Local Resilience Forums, LRFs, document threats to each region according to the function of local and national government, the strategic value of industries based therein, and the overall maintenance of services to the general public, such as fuel, power, healthcare, money, and so on. Britain's regional risk registers are compiled into one nationwide dossier, under which threats such as extreme weather, animal or human-borne pathogens, terrorist attacks, and even public demonstrations constitute the many threats conceived to the general public. There are 38 LRFs in England and Wales, and while their preliminary remit is to ensure the regional delivery of resilience, they're not specifically terrorism analysis centres, but their scope is much broader. However, they are largely responsible for the dissemination of counter-terrorism narratives under the Prevent Manifesto, and it's under this rubric of risk aversion and contingency planning that MIE categories are identified to shape the response of local emergency responders. While UK resilience does not specifically list protests as posing an inherent threat to public safety, a more regionally focused search for the criteria which constitute a civil emergency reveals that a good number of local resilience forums list protests as a severe risk category. Indeed, this programme functions in a similar jurisdictional context to the way in which the DHS fusion centres in America identify their own agendas at a local level. In this respect, the LRFs consider public acts of dissent as a pressing issue for sensitive commercial sites, which are to be protected at all costs from terrorists and other malicious threats. To corroborate this notion, the North Yorkshire Local Resilience Forum performed a review of Operation Harmony in 2006, which was a coordinated effort between local government authorities and emergency responders to contain a mass environmental protest in Selby. And the LRF feedback document on Operation Harmony points out that it cost in the region of £4.5 million. The joint operation was a coordinated public order action at Drax Power Station, which, according to the North Yorkshire Police, was the first time that domestic extremism had taken place in the county. However, what the report does not allude to is the nature of collaborative efforts between private industry and the public sector in relation to resilience planning. According to the Civil Contingency Secretariat, quote, energy services in the UK are wholly privatised and therefore a range of private companies and government organisations are involved in emergency planning for the sector, unquote. Naturally, resilience efforts will include utilities providers, local government authorities and emergency responders. However, in relation to the management of key infrastructure sites, it's also commonplace for private security firms employed by commercial stakeholders to be briefed on any forthcoming matters. For example, during Operation Median at Ratcliffe-on-Soar Power Station in 2009, G4S, Gurkha Security Services and E.ON were extensively consulted in the planning stages of the dispute, which also involved undercover operatives on loan from London's Metropolitan Police. Conclusion. MIE discourse has an international concern. While evidence from international scholars suggests that MIEs are being created under the subterfuge of national security discourse, for policing public protests as criminal acts against the critical public infrastructure, there are clear and evident links to be found between public-private interests within the fusion centres of the UK, Canada and the US. Following the programme of privatisation that took place during the 1980s, Britain's former national industries now constitute a substantial part of this programme. In the UK, at least, the bulk of organisations comprising the critical national infrastructure are commercial ones, although they're joint stakeholders, as with seats of local government and emergency responders. In one respect, that alone might justify the fusion of state and private interests that now monitor the terrorist-slash-extremist threat to the UK. However, the capacity of these organisations to radicalise protest groups under the same rubric as the UK's counter-terrorism doctrine seems all too convenient to their commercial or political aims. What serves as a greater concern, though, is the premise that there now seems to be a unilateral effort in the West to combat all forms of extremism under the same banner of MIE/terrorism, with limited oversight at local, national, or even at a continental level. While this study further articulates Wolby's earlier conceptualization of MIEs and their use by fusion centres to control acts of dissenting public discourse, what remains outstanding is to lay the groundwork for future research into similar PREVENT programmes across mainland Europe. For sure, it's already been noted that Canada, the US and the UK have comparative fusion centres already in existence, or those which are currently emerging, yet this is only the start of what promises to be a coordinated effort across the Western intelligence community and beyond. Indeed, Jones shares these concerns, stating that, quote, in 2012, Europol and the DHS began to cooperate on the issues of countering violent extremism and setting up and maintaining fusion centres. This cooperation has taken the form of reciprocal visits, meetings, briefings and training sessions and makes up a small but potentially significant part of the EU-US cooperation on radicalisation. Work on fusion centres, information gathering and analysis units, seems to be a new area for transatlantic discussion. Unquote. To further develop Europe's emerging network of fusion centres, examples of current establishments include the UK's Joint Terrorist Analysis Centre, JTAC, Denmark's Centre for Terror Analysis, the Joint Center for Countering Extremism and Terrorism in Germany, and Spain's National Center of Anti-Terrorist Coordination. These unilateral fusion centers have established a clear dialogue with other transatlantic and continental partners, such as JTAC and the DHS, but evidently far more research needs to take place in terms of the central effort to police terrorism and counter the threat of multi-issue extremism. Further avenues for research should, in this respect, consider joint forums for sharing good practice, such as the Club to Madrid Group and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Vandana Shiva, soil, not oil. This is the keynote speech by the Indian physicist, ecologist, seed collector, anti-GMO and Monsanto campaigner, teacher of organic agriculture, author, and founder of many vibrant organizations. Just to mention one, Navdanya is serving more than 500,000 farmers, teaches organic farming, and established 60 seed banks in 16 states across India. In a life spanning local action and international politics, academic teaching and gardening alongside her rural neighbors, Vandana Shiva has become an inspiration to many. Her books include Stolen Harvest, Earth Democracy, Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, Water Wars, and Soil, Not Oil. This book, first published in 2007, has become influential beyond its initial success because it addresses the most urgent issue of our time, climate change. As we are becoming more aware that industrial agriculture is a major cause of greenhouse gas emissions that bring about climate change, Vandana Shiva and others are now making the case that restoring the soil and recovering organic agriculture around the world can not only dramatically limit climate change, but even has the capacity to sequester carbon back into the soil that has already been emitted into the air. In September 2015, a two-day conference took place in Richmond, California. They discussed this timely potential in more detail. In honor of Vandana Shiva, the conference and organization were named Soil, Not Oil, and she was asked to give the keynote address. Here she is, Vandana Shiva.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you, Miguel, for everything you did to make the Soil Not Oil conference happen. I wrote Soil Not Oil, I would think nearly a decade ago, because I realized that even though an industrial agriculture model was such a big part of the problem of climate change, agriculture was totally missing from the discussion on climate change. And in fact, right up to the conference in Copenhagen, which was destroyed, which was scuttled, as Eva Morales said, it became really an agreement between the polluters to keep polluting. And they killed the UN treaty at that time in order to have a consensus between the five big polluters. And that's when Eva Morales went back and said, we're going to write a declaration for the rights of Mother Earth, which we did. That what we are talking about really is our role on this beautiful earth. Our role either to be passive, because I don't think any of us are big players in the destruction, but we do lend support to that system when we don't break away from it. First in our minds and our hearts, and then through the actions that we take, through the way we live. And Soil Not Oil came so naturally to me to say, we have lived for about 2.5 centuries in an age of oil, which built on 500 years of the age of colonialism. But it aggravated every trend of colonization. There would be no oil empire today without wars. Oil means wars. The age of oil is the age of wars for oil and for other resource grabs. Because it's only with the age of oil that it became possible to expand the footprint anywhere. If the British hadn't shifted their production on the basis of coal, the earlier stage of fossil fuels, they wouldn't have been able to come to this land to grow cotton. It's those machines that ran on coal that had such a huge appetite. The spinning wheel that Gandhi spun had a limited appetite. So the land was taken from the Native Americans, and then the big cotton plantations need workers. So a few Africans were grabbed, brought to this country as slaves. India had to be colonized for her cotton as well as indigo. And the entire colonial expansion was driven first by fossil fuels in the form of coal and then oil. The age of oil should get over, so the age of soil can begin. Syria is part of that amazing world, which is called the Golden Crescent, which is where we get our wheat and our barley and our oats. This is the region that is called the origin of an agriculture that's linked to wheat. Of course, there's the culture of corn from Mexico. There's the culture of the millets. There's the culture of other grains. This year is the year of soil, and that's why we've gathered together to celebrate soil. So we decided to write a manifesto collectively. A group of people got together in Italy, and we wrote a manifesto on soil, but on our commons and our future. And the title is Terra Viva. It's available for you to download. But while we were drafting it, the first few boats had started to sink in the Mediterranean. And we wanted to connect not just what's with happening to soil, what, you know, you heard from Ratan Lal, one of the top soil scientists this morning, you heard from Fritz of Capra, one of the top system scientists of the world. We know now, after being fooled for about 75 years, that the soil is an empty container to pour chemical fertilizer into, that the soil is the most amazing living ecosystem, most diverse, more diverse than the plants that we see above the soil or the fish in the ocean, the microorganisms, we are still trying to catch up with what's going on in the soil. We wanted to do more with this manifesto. We wanted to connect what was not being seen as connected. And the two new problems that have arisen in terms of violence since 2009, very recent, just 6 years ago, are aspects of Syria and Boko Haram. Just today there was an item that 2.1 million Nigerians have been displaced because of Boko Haram. And of course, more than 6 million Syrians have been turned into refugees. There was no problem in Syria of this scale before 2009. And there was no Boko Haram before 2009. So we decided to look at the roots. What happened in 2009? Where Boko Haram has risen is an area supported by Lake Chad. 9 million people made their living from that lake. It's 5% today compared to what it used to be in the 60s. When 9 million people lose their livelihoods, society starts to disintegrate. Part of it shows up as conflicts. In Syria, Syria was not part of the Arab Spring. It did not see the uprisings of Tunisia and Egypt or Bahrain. But in 2009, there was an extended drought. And extreme climate events are part of climate change. We've had droughts before, but they didn't come that frequently. They didn't last that long. We've had cyclones before, but they never had the frequency and the intensity that they do now. We've had heavy rains before, but the intensity of flooding is something we're witnessing now. My own region in the Himalaya, we had in 2 days, on the 16th and 17th of June 2013, such heavy rain. It was 350% more than normal, and it washed away villages, bridges, schools, communities, roads. We've not seen that happen. We haven't seen the desert of Ladakh, which is a high altitude desert, ever have rain. It's a desert. Now they get such heavy rain that they're flooding. In 2010, they lost 200 people washed away in the Indus. And the drought that hit Syria in 2009 created an unprecedented crisis. And as I've noticed with every cyclone in India or the floods of the Himalaya, the climate extremes build on the maldevelopment that makes ecosystems vulnerable and fragile. So Syria, like every other place, has been fed with an industrial agriculture model, new seeds adapted to chemicals, needing lots of irrigation in an area that is arid. When the drought hits, those varieties fail. Native varieties, after all, native varieties evolved in that land and were meant to grow with low rainfall. But the new varieties need irrigation. Because of irrigation, the waters disappeared. In that 1 year of 2009, the drought was so intense that 1 million people got displaced from agriculture and pastoralism. 85% of the agriculture and livestock was destroyed. And when that kind of number arrived in the cities, the government reacted the way governments do, with violence. But there was another aspect linked to this. Because of structural adjustment, because of globalization and free trade, all governments are prevented from supporting their farmers because they're supposed to support trade and big ag and big business. The violence was helped. A regime change started. Arms started to flow instead of food. And today the reportings from Syria are so confused, nobody anymore knows who's fighting whom and who is whom. But we do know little babies like Aylan are losing their lives. And because we built our economics, our politics, our cosmology around oil. If you think of it, industrialism begins with fossil fuels. The entire thinking in terms of a fragmented mindset, in terms of a separation from nature, a separation within nature, all of that is a result of the fact that we could ignore the vibrant ecological cycles of the earth. And imagine that we could cheat nature with fossil fuels. We created an entire scientific and technological edifice to help us with that cheating. But beyond a point, the limits come and hit. Climate change is one of those limits where planetary boundaries are being broken, but the consequences are real and they are huge. A second consequence was the way we've defined the economy. I get so surprised when they talk about efficiency and productivity in agriculture. How can industrial agriculture, which uses 10 times more inputs as energy to provide one calorie of food, be called efficient? It is so inefficient that if any other sector worked on that logic, it would collapse. The reason industrial agriculture carries on inefficiently is because it is subsidized at every level. It's subsidized through subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. It is subsidized through subsidies to chemical fertilizers that are based on fossil fuels. My own country in 2008 was giving so much subsidy. It was nearly a trillion rupees of subsidy to nitrogen fertilizers. And that was more than our defense budget. And where does that subsidy go? To the Cargills. Where did the fertilizers come from? In the soil, they come from the amazing microorganisms, from the earthworms, from all of the richness of life. Nitrogen fertilizers made synthetically come from the same factories that made explosives during the war. And that's why you wouldn't be surprised that so many of the bombs of recent times are fertilizer bombs. The Oklahoma bombing, fertilizer bomb. The Oslo bombings, that young boy had been collecting fertilizers for months, and then he used that as a bomb. Even Afghanistan, most of the bombs are fertilizer bombs. It's inefficient in other ways. But the trick is, you've totally redefined the economy. And, you know, I sometimes do get amazed at the human species, that we can be taken to such levels of stupidity. For centuries on end, and we accept it. Take the stupidity of measuring productivity in agriculture on the basis of reducing human beings in farming. Wendell Berry has written this beautiful essay of farmland without farmers. And that's the definition of productivity, because you, in terms of output, productivity is output per unit input. When your output is only measuring commodities that go to be substitutes for fossil fuel in terms of form of biofuel or animal feed, it doesn't really matter what its nutrition is. So the output is commodities, and the more you can convert food into commodities, the more growth you have. And when the denominator is human beings, and I have heard brilliant people say, we've got to reduce the denominator to improve the GDP in agriculture. And I've had to remind very high-level people, what you call the denominator is an equal citizen of the earth and the country as you. They are people. Farmers are not denominators. Farmers are carers and stewards of the seed and the soil and the climate. And that's the most important point, farmers and gardeners. They're definitely not producers of commodities. They're producers of nourishment. Very often the debate will come up and people say, oh, but organic is costly. And I remind them about the subsidies, $400 billion annually and more than $1 billion a day to make costly oil-based food. We literally are eating oil, as I've written in my book, Soil, Not Oil. We're eating oil. We should be eating soil. Albert Howard, who was sent to India in 1905 to introduce modern agriculture, as they said, arrived, found the soils were fertile, couldn't find a pest damaging the crops. And as he wrote in his book called The Agricultural Testament, I decided to make the pest and the peasant my professors. And he literally studied under them, under nature and Indian farmers practicing an agriculture based on diversity, on the law of return to the soil, on integrating trees and livestock and crops. And the book he wrote, The Agricultural Testament, is today called The Bible of Modern Organic Farming. Albert Howard could recognize that the Indian farmer could teach more to the world about taking care of the soil than the top scientists of England of that time. He was humble enough to draw humility from the soil, and it's fascinating, the word humus, which he used very intensely, which humus is soil in its full life, and its roots are Latin, and the same word that refers to living soil is at the root of our humanity. The word human is derived from humus, and we forget that. We separate ourselves from the soil at very high cost, because oil has made us disillusioned. Howard wrote in his book, Soil and Health, health is one continuum from the soil to the plants to the human being. And so when small farmers do good farming, taking care of the soil and producing nourishment, they are our physicians. When you go to a physician, you don't bargain and say $40 for a consultancy is too much. But how people bicker over $1 in food. Part of our work is to change the distortions, not just in the way we produce our food, but the way it is costed and priced. So we've done new studies based on our working with biodiversity and intensity. We've done new studies based on doing the true cost accounting in agriculture. Our book on measuring nutrition, which we call health per acre. Normally the measure in industrial agriculture based on fossil fuels is yield per acre. And yield only measures the commodity that left the farm. It doesn't measure the output, the diversity that you can grow on the farm. It doesn't measure the health of the soil, the richness of biodiversity, whether your soils have the ability to conserve moisture or not, an issue that is so relevant today in California. You know, with 0.5% organic matter in soil, we can have 80,000 liters per hectare of water in the soil. We wouldn't experience drought. We see that all the time in our farms. In the same area with the same drought, the organic farms are producing food. And the chemical farms, called the Green Revolution farms in India, have absolute crop failure. With 1%, you can hold 100,000 liters, and with 5%, 800,000 liters. So the answer to drought is the same answer to nourishment and health, because industrial agriculture has produced nutritionally empty commodities loaded with toxics. And the damage to health is twofold. because of the micronutrient deficiencies on the one hand, but the toxics on the other. And if we start to internalize those costs, we just couldn't afford farming with oil and eating oil. It would just be too costly for our bodies and the planet. We would pack it up. And we will have to pack it up, because we are the ones who, with the earth, are paying the full price.
That was the first part of a 45-minute speech by Vandana Shiva from India. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
You're about to hear was made last Sunday at Monument Square in Concord, where the Climate Justice Rally was being held. The first voice you're going to hear on the recording is Bob Lawson, a local activist, a very active local activist, and he is going to be introducing the main speaker, Wynn Stevenson.
Before I bring on Wynn, I just thought I'd ramble here a little bit. I'm just thinking about us, climate activists around the world. And although the climb can seem so steep and so impossible, I feel like we're making cracks. I feel like the climate discussion is actually finally entering into the national conversation. I mean, when I think back to an election 4 years ago, climate change was never mentioned once in the entire election. We talked about everything but climate change, except when Mitt Romney broke the silence and mocked it to the derisive laughter of the entire Republican convention. It was a very low moment in our history. He just talked about the rising seas and laughed, and everybody booed and laughed, and it was horrible. You know, the other day I just saw the very first political presidential advertisement I've ever seen. It was Bernie Sanders. And he mentioned climate change. And there was climate change in it. And this year in a Republican convention, because people like us, you know, tweeted Jake Tapper and said, you have to ask a question on climate. Well, somehow he did, between, you know, way at the end, like right after legalization of pot and maternity leave, you know, way at the end, he asked a question on climate, and of course the 12 dunces on the stage couldn't deal with it, but at least it got brought up. So we are making a difference. You know, Keystone got nixed. Yeah. As Bill McKibben said, we did that. That's why Keystone got nixed. And so we got to keep it up. We got to keep up the pressure in Paris. And we got to step up our game, and that's largely what Wynn's going to talk about. But we do have to step it up, because a chart I saw done by a group of, you know, serious researchers showed that the proposals now on the table in Paris, if those proposals went through, we would still rise 3.5 degrees centigrade. If we go on with business as usual, we're going to rise 4.5 degrees. And, of course, the last climate summit, we all agreed in the world that 2 degrees was it. So this Paris thing has not only got to, you know, happen, but it's also got to ramp up in the years following Paris. So we got to keep up this fight no matter what they do, because the Paris proposals, as they stand now, are still spelling climate tragedy. I mean, that's how dire the whole situation is. It's interesting to know that in the Ice Age, when where we're standing right now, we were covered with a mile or maybe 2 miles of ice, the average global temperature was only 6 degrees colder than it is now. 6 degrees difference made miles of ice. And we're going towards 3, 4, maybe 2. I think the world sucks now with the climate. So, I mean, imagine it getting it worse. And I don't understand why it's so hard to get this message through. Sometimes I'm just so baffled why our message is so hard to get through. I mean, I watch the evening news, and I watch the streets of Houston flooded in water, and I watch neighborhoods burning down in California, and I said, all we're trying to do is stop this kind of stuff. Is that such an outlandishly radical thing to want to do? I mean, if ISIS came in, or a terrorist group, and did one of those destructive events, we'd go fight a 10-year war for it. But when our warming Earth's climate and weather does that, we just go, huh, what are you going to do? I just don't get it. So let's keep it up. And there's no one here better to inspire us to do that than Wen Stevenson. He's a former journalist, producer at NPR, written for all kinds of prestigious magazines and newspapers. Thank you. She's very helpful. Here's his book. What we're fighting for now is each other. It's a fantastic book. Yeah. And, you know, as you leave here, you could just walk down to the bookstore and buy it. Because you want it. You really do. It's a fantastic book. It's very inspirational. Wen is very inspirational. So he had this great journalistic producer career going. And 2010, he woke up one morning and said, you know, how can I do anything but work for the climate? So he left all that behind. Well, he's still writing, but everything he's doing now is focusing on climate because he wants us to step up our game. So come on up, Wen, and tell us how to do it.
I've been thinking a lot about, probably too much, about what sort of words can actually capture the true weight of this moment, you know, this historical moment, our moment. As, you know, the nations of the world converge on Paris, you know, and seemingly every non-governmental organization on the planet that's devoted to environment or climate and energy and economic development and poverty and human rights. And let's not forget the corporations. The corporations and their lobbyists, of course. You know, but not just NGOs and corporations and world leaders. But, you know, people. Like all of you. Like me. Folks, like actual citizens, converging on Paris to, you know, try to come up with a global response and what many would now, some think, is an impossible response to this unfolding catastrophe, this global climate catastrophe that is unfolding before our eyes. And now, as of just a couple of weeks ago, trying to do this in the midst of violence and fear and repression. Climate activists are now being, in some cases, stopped and prevented from getting into France. Some are under house arrest. The mass mobilizations have been canceled. You know, meanwhile, you know, sporting events are okay, apparently, during this, but not massive climate marches. You know, they don't even have to go to Paris for that kind of thing. You know, on the op-ed page of the Boston Globe, we have esteemed academics telling us that, you know, the climate movement really ought to just calm down a little bit and hit the pause button. How many of you feel like hitting the pause button? Yeah, that's what I thought. So what words can really, you know, capture this moment? Well, a few of us just walked down to Walden Pond a few minutes ago. That made me think of these words. If I have unjustly wrested a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself.
I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. Yeah, Henry David Thoreau wrote that. In the radical abolitionist essay called Resistance to Civil Government, better known as Civil Disobedience. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. Think about that. So, at the end of the summer of 2012, something like 80% of the so-called, what used to be called the permanent Arctic sea ice, floating sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean, 80% is measured by volume, was gone, melted. Did you know that? 80%. You know, it fluctuates a bit from year to year. It's somewhere around 75 or 80% right now. But scientists are telling us that, you know, we may very well have an ice-free Arctic summer within the next decade. Something that the human species has never witnessed. What we know for sure is that the rate at which the Arctic is melting far, far exceeds what the scientific models predicted. And we know that the stability of the global climate system depends largely on the Arctic. The window in which to prevent the worst scenarios is literally closing before our eyes. This is really happening. This is really happening. Meanwhile, and I'm sorry, but it has to be said, meanwhile, the fossil fuel industry and those that do its bidding, the fossil fuel industry, which holds in its carbon reserves, we now know, holds the fate of humanity and of life on Earth in those carbon reserves. The industry has something like 5 times more carbon in its reserves globally than the science says can ever be burned sanely if we want to hold global warming to a so-called safe level. And yet, its business model, its profit model, requires, at this point, you know, extracting and burning every bit of it. In fact, hundreds of billions of dollars are being spent every year still on exploration and development of new reserves, including drilling. You know, they really would love to drill up there in that melted Arctic. Because apparently 5 times isn't enough. This is really happening. We face an unprecedented situation, a radical situation. It requires a radical response. That is a serious response. A serious response. Right? This number that we all have heard, 2 degrees, which is what the Paris Climate Summit is all about, supposedly. Right? There's good reason to believe that even a rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average will result in disastrous consequences beyond humanity's control. All right? In fact, given what we're already seeing, having raised the temperature about 1 degree Celsius, all right, catastrophic, quote-unquote catastrophic warming is already happening. Because, this is what I want you to remember, what is quote-unquote catastrophic depends on where you live and how poor you are. And more often than not, the color of your skin. Yep. That's right.
Yeah.
And so, if you're one of the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet, the majority, actually, of the world's population, you know, in Bangladesh or the Sahel or Louisiana or maybe the Rockaways, even 1 degree can mean and has meant catastrophe. Right, so we're not really having an honest conversation, globally or nationally, about this situation, right?
The question now is not whether we're going to, quote unquote, stop global warming or solve the climate crisis. Right? We have a climate crisis. We're in it. This is it. Okay? The question is whether humanity is actually going to act quickly and decisively enough to salvage civilization itself in any form worth salvaging. That's what I want to argue here, all right? Right? Whether any kind of stable and humane and just future, any kind of just society, is still possible. What do you really care about, you know? Is a just society still possible? Well, it is. It is still possible, right? That is what the climate and energy experts of the world are trying to explain to us, okay? That the barriers, as seemingly insurmountable as they may be, are no longer technological or financial, right? They're political. They're political. Which is to say, they're moral. They're moral. Let's be clear. Let's be crystal clear about what that means, right? Given what we know and have known for decades about climate change, in fact, what we now know ExxonMobil has known about climate change for decades, right? To deny the science and deceive the public and willfully obstruct any serious response to this global emergency, right, is to willfully allow the eradication of entire countries and cultures. Okay? It is to rob people, starting with the poorest and most vulnerable on the planet, of their land, their homes, their livelihoods, even their lives, and their children's lives, and their children's children's lives, for profit, and for political power. There's a word for this. These are crimes. These are crimes against the earth, and they are crimes against humanity. They're crimes against humanity. So what is, I mean, how do you respond to something like that? You know, what is the proper response to that? You know, remain calm, we're told. You know, no scare tactics or hysterics, please. You know, cooler heads will prevail. Enjoy the Earth Day festivities. You know, hit the pause button. Everything's fine, nothing to see here. Cooler heads will prevail. Well, look, I agree. You know, scare tactics and hysterics are not helpful. But I'm sorry. The cooler heads have not prevailed. All right? It's been a quarter century since the alarm was sounded. The cooler heads have failed. They've failed. You want, you know, calm, cool-headed reason? How about this? Masses of people, most of them young, a generation with little or nothing to lose, physically non-violently disrupting the fossil fuel industry and those that support it and abet it. Yeah, getting in the way of business as usual, forcing the issue, like they've been doing down in Boston where Spectra Energy is trying to build a pipeline right through West Roxbury. Well, guess what? Over 40 people got arrested on that pipeline route, including some people here today. And Spectra went home for the winter early. That's right. They'll be back in the spring, but so will we. So will we. That's just one example. Yeah, acting like, you know, we actually believe what the science is telling us. Acting like, you know, we actually care about our fellow human beings. Now look, this is hard, right? I always like to just sort of cut through the rhetoric, you know, at some point and just admit that this is really hard. Coming to terms with the climate catastrophe is hard. It's frightening. It's infuriating. And it's heartbreaking, right? So again, how do you respond? What is the response to this? So, you know, rather than giving in to retreating into various forms of denial and fatalism and cynicism and all that, more and more people are realizing, you know, that it's going to take something more than just quote-unquote environmentalism. You know, it was never really fair to leave this up to the environmentalists in the first place, right? It's going to take something more than environmentalism and, you know, virtuous green consumerism, you know, to deal with this situation. That, you know, if the only thing at this point that's actually going to avert an apocalyptic future and to actually help us get through what we know is coming with our humanity intact is the kind of truly transformative social and political movement that has changed the course of history in the past. That's right. You know, the kind of movement that made possible what was previously unthinkable. Whether it was the abolition of slavery, or civil rights, the right of women to vote, labor rights, civil rights, gay rights, all you go down the line. Right? These things happened because radical social movements forced the issue. Took ideas and demands and concepts that were previously considered completely out of the mainstream, completely radical, and forced them into the mainstream. That's the way revolutionary change happens. That's right. But to do that, you know, to actually get the kind of movement that we need, I think first we have to acknowledge that our mainstream environmental movement and the, you know, corporate controlled political system through which it has tried to work for decades has failed. Has failed. You know, that we've already lost the, quote, climate fight. If that means solving the climate crisis and saving some semblance of the world that we know. Right? That it was lost before it began. Because it started so late. Right? And that it's time now to fight like there's nothing left to lose. But our humanity. Like there's nothing left to lose but our humanity. Now, some of the same folks who, you know, write op-eds for the Boston Globe telling us to hit the pause button, you know, they also tell us, you know, don't make this climate change thing, you know, sound like a left-wing issue. By which they mean, you know, don't make it about justice or human rights or any of that stuff. And, you know, it is true that there are a lot of people, including among climate experts, who don't really like to talk about justice. They don't really like to talk about race or about inequality of all sorts, about the distribution of wealth, the national level or, you know, much less the global level, where, as none other than Pope Francis recently reminded us, we owe the rest of the world, the developing world, the majority of the world's population, a massive climate and ecological debt. That's right. You know, and I don't really like to talk about the fact that women, in particular, bear the brunt of climate change globally. Do you know that? I mean, when we say those often repeated words, the poorest and most vulnerable, more often than not, that means a woman, and indeed a woman of color. So yeah. And you know what? I don't really like to talk about those things either. You know, because look at me, right? It puts me on the spot. Right? But if I'm serious about this, if I'm serious about justice, and if I'm serious about climate, like morally serious about it, I have to face these things. All right. Yeah. Thank you. And here's why. Here's why I have to face these things. Because when we look at what is coming, what we know is coming, right? Even if we do everything right from this point on and keep carbon in the ground, even, given what we know is still coming, the amount of climate change that's in the pipeline, so to speak. You know, our fights for social justice and human rights and real democracy matter more than ever. Because when we stare that climate reality in the face and we think about what we're facing and what our children and grandchildren's generations are facing, you know, and when we look at what, you know, we think about, you know, scarcity and instability and conflict, and when we look at what those with wealth and power, you know, are likely willing to do to hold on to their wealth and power, you know, when we see this country scapegoating entire classes of people and closing our doors to desperate refugees? Yeah, when we look at all of that and we think about what we're facing, it matters all the more what kind of a government we have, what kind of a democracy we have, what kind of, hey, a constitution we have. Depends. It matters all the more what kind of a society we have and what kind of a people we're going to be as we head into that future. That's right. So look, I only have a little bit more to say. You know, I realize that any sort of talk of a, you know, radical, transformative movement, you know, just can sound hopelessly, you know, naive, right? You know, the people like me are out of touch with political reality, right? I mean, you know, I spent the better part of 2 decades as a journalist in national media. You know, I do know the country and the political culture in which I work, right? But here I am anyway. Because here's the thing. I also know that abolishing slavery sounded hopeless and naive in 1857, when Frederick Douglass said, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress." I know that ending Jim Crow sounded hopeless and naive in 1955, when Rosa Parks stayed in her seat on that bus in Montgomery. Right? I also know that even something as seemingly simple and obvious as rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline sounded hopeless and naive in 2011, before thousands of people started getting arrested, putting their bodies on the line, and in places like East Texas, some people risking their lives to stop a pipeline. And before, that's right, and before a president of the United States started listening. Yeah, and guess what? Yes, it's just one pipeline. One very big, very dangerous, very symbolic and political pipeline. And you know what? Montgomery, Alabama was just one southern city. And that bus was just one city bus.
Hello?
But when? Isn't it too late? Isn't it too late for all of that? I don't know. Is it?
No.
Yeah, you tell me. Is it too late? We know what the science says. What does your conscience say? What does too late even mean? Too late for what? You know, even in the face of all we now know, will it ever be too late to hold on to some kind of faith in human decency? Or some kind of hope, as irrational as it may seem sometimes, in our fellow human beings? Or, you know, to love our brothers and sisters on this planet? Because those things, faith and hope and love, are every bit as real as the science. They're every bit. That's right. They're every bit as real as the CO2 in the atmosphere and the carbon in the ground. They're as real as the melting Arctic and the acidifying oceans. And you know what else? Those things, faith and hope and love, are the very stuff that movements are made of. Real movements. The kind of radical, transformative movements that have changed the course of history in the past, and maybe, just maybe, might change it again if enough of us are willing to fight, and fight hard enough, and fight lovingly enough, and never give up. Thank you.